Random House Audiobooks presents Tom Clancy's Net Force, Hidden Agendas, created by Tom Clancy and Steve Pachenik. Read for you by Carrie Shale.
Wednesday, December 15th, 2010, 2:44 a.m., Baton Rouge, Louisiana. A cold and damp winter wind played around the windows of the new building. Alone inside, the night watchman, watchwoman in this case, pored over the laptop on the guard station's desk, adding a few personal notes to the text on the strata of rock formations. Catherine Brandt sighed. Geology. Ooh. Kat had taken 2 semesters of political science at LSU, where she was thankfully a senior. Studying politics was almost a necessity in Louisiana, where people still spoke fondly of Huey Long, the governor-turned-senator who'd been assassinated just up the hall there more than 75 years past. Working your way through school as a guard at the state capitol wasn't the best job in the world, but it left plenty of time to study. That was the main thing. Her comm buzzed. She grinned and pulled the tiny unit from her belt.
Hey.
Hey, Kat, her husband said.
How come you're still awake?
Kat asked. You'll never make Lardass's class. I'll piss on him. I miss you, all alone here in this big old bed, full of lust for my new wife. She laughed.
I am tempted.
She never finished the sentence. The compression shockwave blasted her so hard that if the investigators hadn't known who she was, they would never have been able to identify her, not even using dental records. Friday, December 17th, 12:55 p.m., Quantico, Virginia. Alexander Michaels, commander of the FBI's elite Net Force unit, fell on the floor, smack on his butt. The woman who had just slammed him was his chief deputy, Assistant Commander Antonella Tony Fiorella. He could barely breathe. Smiling took everything he had.
You okay?
He managed to suck in enough air to say, yeah, fine. After a month of training, 5 days a week, at least Michaels could finally get the name of the system right. Pakulan Pentjak Silat, or Silat for short. Tony had learned it from an old Dutch-Indonesian woman who had lived across the street from the Fiorellas in the Bronx, after she had witnessed the old woman use the art against 4 gangbangers who had tried to run the granny off her door stoop. A big mistake, that. Tony leapt at him. Michaels, rattled, blocked and stepped to the inside of Tony's leading foot. His right thigh slid between Tony's legs and pressed against her pubis. His concentration on protecting himself just kind of evaporated. He was very much aware of the warmth of her crotch, astraddle his thigh, even through 2 sets of sweatpants. Damn. Alex. Michaels shook the erotic thoughts. Jay Gridley stood near the gym's entrance, looking at the two of them. The younger man was grinning.
Jay, what's up?
You said you wanted to hear about that Louisiana thing as soon as it came in. I just downloaded the packet from the field team in Baton Rouge.
Michaels nodded and looked at Tony.
I need to check that out.
They bowed to each other, the intricate Silat beginning and ending salute, and Michaels headed for the dressing room. Sheldon Gainel Warsham was 16 years old, a student at New Istroma High School. He looked about 12, was thin, and had black, oily hair slicked down all over. The man seated across the table was heavy-set, florid-faced, and he might as well have had cop flashing in neon over his head.
So tell me about this bomb.
Yeah, okay. So we're not talking Semtex or C4 or crap like that. We're talking RQX-71.
Where'd you get it, this explosive?
I made it in the chem lab.
You made it, and took down a brand new 3-story steel-framed office building with it.
The Couser shouldn't have fired my dad, you pross.
And how did you happen to come up with the top-secret formula for this RAQ?
Now the kid favored the cop with his biggest grin yet.
That was the easy part. I scarfed it off the net.
Jay Gridley touched a control, and the hollow prodge of the interrogation faded.
Kids don't relate to death. Too much income, too many vids, too much VR slaughter rooming.
Michaels shook his head. What kind of scum would do something like this? The Warsham boy was obviously bent, missing a few key neurons in his brain, but whoever posted the formula for the explosive was really sick. They needed to find him, fast.
Alex?
He looked at Tony.
Joanna Winthrop is coming in at 2:30.
Gridley snorted.
Lightweight light. What's she want?
Lieutenant Winthrop is going to be assisting us on this matter.
What? I don't need her, boss. I can run this dweebo to ground without some airhead sim-bimbo.
Michael's tone was sharp.
As I recall, her grade point average was higher than yours.
Gridley nodded, but his jaw muscles flexed as he gritted his teeth. Michael's temporary secretary came into the conference room.
Commander, I have Director Carver on the phone.
I'll take it in my office. Get busy, folks.
Friday, December 17th, 1:45 p.m., Washington, D.C. Thomas Hughes strode into the senatorial offices as if he owned them. He waved at the receptionist.
Bertha, is he alone?
Yes, sir, Mr. Hughes.
Jason Robert White, 56, the senior United States senator from the great state of Ohio, sat at his desk. He was playing a computer game.
Hey, Tom.
He did a finger wave over the sensor on his hand pad, and the small-scale holoproj images froze. White appeared 10 years younger than his actual age, with a deep chemical tan under his perfectly styled, artfully graying hair. He wore a dark blue tailored Saigon suit and a striped regimental tie for a regiment that never existed. Hughes, on the other hand, knew he looked every day of his 52 years and that he was 20 pounds too heavy. White waved at the computer projection, frozen over his workstation.
You ever played Dino Wars?
I can't say as I have, no.
Very stimulating mano-a-mano combat scenario.
Hughes smiled and tried not to show the contempt he felt. White was rich, the son, grandson, and great-grandson of wealthy men. It wasn't just a silver spoon he'd been born with, but a platinum one encrusted with diamonds.
That bombing in Louisiana?
Oh, yeah, terrible thing.
The kid who did it got the formula for the explosive off the net.
No shit.
White leaned forward.
I think this plays right into your hearings on NetForce.
That's true.
You might want to mention it when the budget hits the table.
After the senator was gone, Hughes went down the hall to his own office. He'd been very careful about living beyond his means. His public face was exactly what was expected for a senator's chief of staff, but under various guises, Hughes had a fat line of electronic credit. He nodded at Cheryl, his secretary.
Anything pressing?
Your massage therapist called. She'll be at your house at 7.
Hughes nodded. Britt would give him a good massage, that was true enough, but that was only half of the service she provided. He went into his office and closed the door behind him. The room was a Spartan affair, whose only artwork was a Picasso on the wall. He didn't particularly care for Picasso, but a picture worth that much certainly impressed people who did. The comm chirped.
The vice president is on 3.
I'll take it, but let's let him wait a few seconds. We don't need an uppity vice president, do we?
Friday, December 17th, 2:40 p.m., Quantico, Virginia. In his office, Alex Michaels looked at the clock blinking in the corner of his default holoproj.
Liza, isn't Lieutenant Winthrop on for 2:30?
She's here, sir, but she's occupied.
Occupied? Michaels went out to see what was going on. On the floor next to his secretary's desk, with a rat's nest of red, white, and blue wires on her lap, sat Joanna Winthrop. She had a pocket tool of some kind, probably a Leatherman, and was using it to twist two of the colored wires together. Winthrop was one of the most beautiful women Michaels had ever seen. She was tall, lean, had long, honey-blonde hair pinned up, and green eyes that put expensive emeralds to shame.
Try it now.
Liza tapped at her command module's keyboard.
Hey, it works. Thank you.
Michaels gestured at the door and waited for her to precede him into the office. It wasn't just to get a look at her backside, although he had to admit that was worth seeing.
Thanks for fixing the keyboard.
My pleasure.
He moved behind his desk, sat, and gestured for Winthrop to do the same.
We have a little problem, Lieutenant. Colonel Howard thought you might be willing to help us out.
Yes, sir.
Yours was the first name he suggested when I asked him for assistance.
Sir, if it's all the same to you, please call me Joe.
Fine, Joe. Might as well call me Alex while we're at it.
Yes, sir. I mean, right, Alex. So, what's up?
He smiled at her and waved his hand over his computer controls. Saturday, December 18th, 7:50 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. Colonel John Howard wore his old Gore-Tex windbreaker, covering the S&W Model 66 357 short-barreled revolver nestled in the Galco paddle holster just behind the point of his right hip. 10 yards away, a mugger with a knife leapt out of the darkness and ran at him. The assassin was no more than 2 seconds away. At this range, trying to line up the sights was too slow. Howard glanced at the computer next to the shooting box. There was a small hollow projection of the mugger over the computer and stats under it. Elapsed time, 1.34 seconds from start to shot. Organ hit, heart.
Not bad for an old man,
Sergeant Julio Fernandez said. Morning, gentlemen, he heard somebody say behind him. The wolf-ear headphones he wore amplified normal sounds, but cut out anything loud enough to damage his hearing. He turned. It was his boss, Alexander Michaels.
Commander, what brings you to the range on a Saturday morning?
Michaels patted the taser clipped to his belt on his right hip.
Requalification. Thought I'd come down when it wasn't too busy.
Howard held his grin. Whatever Michaels said, he had faced an assassin who had snuck into HQ, and he'd shot her dead using her own gun. That had earned him a bit of respect in a lot of opinions, including Howard's own.
I'll let you get back to your practice, Michaels said. Have a good day, gentlemen.
He walked to the end of the long row of shooting boxes and began to set up for his session. At the end of the row of shooting boxes, Michaels heard the colonel and sergeant laughing. Well, not everybody was a soldier. His father had been a career army man, and that had been enough to sour Michaels on it. He knew he could kill somebody, if it was self-defense, or to protect somebody he loved. He set his computer for a practice run on the taser qualification scenario, checked to make sure the spare compressed gas cartridge holder was on the left side of his belt, and then pulled the taser and inspected the weapon to make certain the cartridge in it was still active. The compressed gas propellant, nitrogen or carbon dioxide, depending on the model, would spit the needles up to 50 feet with enough force to penetrate clothing. At normal combat range, about 7 or 8 yards, the weapon delivered a knockdown jolt virtually every time. Of course, such a device could be used by the bad guys, too. To counter that, all tasers were required to carry taggants in their propellants, thousands of tiny bits of colored or clear plastic that would identify the registered buyer. There was no way to sweep all these tags up after a taser was fired. A mugger appeared and ran at Michaels. He had a crowbar in one hand. Michaels thumbed the firing stud, and a splash of yellow light flared on the mugger's leg, but he kept coming. Shit. By the time Michaels got the thing reloaded, the mugger was on him. The computer image to Michaels' left strobed the letters FTSG in bright red. Failure to stop. Gotcha. Had this been a real mugger, Michaels would have been looking at a crushed skull, unless Tony's CLAT instruction would have let him dance the crowbar and poke the guy with the stun gun electrode. He pointedly did not look at Howard and Fernandez. He knew they'd be smiling. Saturday, December 18th, 8:15 a.m., Washington, D.C. Tony sat on the lounger her oldest brother, Junior, had given her for Christmas 3 years ago. She smiled into the phone, a Vox-only connection with her mother. Mama had never cottoned on to the idea of picture phones.
Mama, if you're so worried about how much these calls are costing me, why don't you get an ISDN or a DL and let Aldo hook Papa's computer to it? For $10 a month, we could talk over the net as much as we want.
It's too complicated.
Tony grinned again. Mama would never change.
So when are you coming home?
Thursday night, late. They're giving us the 24th off.
You need Papa to pick you up at the airport.
Papa is not supposed to be driving, Mama. He can't see that good.
You know your father. He don't hear what he don't want to hear.
I'm not flying, Mama. I'm taking the train, and I'll catch a cab from the station.
Late at night, my daughter should be in a cab.
Don't worry about me. I got my key. I'll go to the guest unit. Don't worry, Mama. I'll see you Christmas Eve morning, okay?
Tony put the phone down and shook her head. One of the joys of her big Catholic family was the annual holiday gathering. Too bad she couldn't bring Alex with her. Mama would be so thrilled that Tony had a potential husband, and any man she looked at more than twice was, as far as Mama was concerned, a potential husband. Maybe someday. Saturday, December 18th, 11:45 a.m., Arizona Territory. Jay Gridley rode the net. On a horse. Until recently, he had favored a Dodge Viper in virtual reality, playing scenarios that involved superhighways and high speed. But he'd gotten into a Western frame of mind a couple of weeks ago. In this scenario, Jay wore buttonfly Levi's, real cowhide pointed-toe cowboy boots, and a Colt 45 Peacemaker six-gun strapped around his waist. He had thought about a white horse or even a Palomino, but figured those were maybe a bit over the top. Most of the off-the-shelf software would never have gotten into this kind of detail, but they weren't held to his standards. He reined up next to a dried and dusty stream bed, dismounted, and took a swig from his water bottle, a canvas bag with a wooden plug. From around the bend came the sound of an approaching wagon. The horse's shoes clop-clopped on the hardpan, and the iron-bound wooden wheels clattered over small rocks. The driver was a woman, in a ground-length cotton dress that had once been dyed indigo. On the seat next to her was a thin stack of books. Why, it must be the schoolmarm.
"Howdy, ma'am." "Aw, hell, it weren't no schoolmarm. It was Lieutenant Joanna Bimbo Winthrop. Damn."
"Well, yee-haw, little dogies,"
she said. She smiled. In the real world, Jay was sitting in his office chair at HQ, wearing full VR gear, connected to his workstation and the net. In RW, he finger-jived out of his old West program to let Winthrop's vehicle become the default. He found himself on the boarding platform at a train station. Winthrop stood across from him, and a passenger train was stopped behind her. And looking around, he saw she had done a pretty clean job on the scenario. No gray areas, no sketchy backgrounds, plenty of detail, even to the wood grain, in the fir posts supporting the platform roof. Well, okay, he had to admit it. This was a first-class piece of work. He didn't have to admit that to her, however. He overrode her program, and half a second later was back standing in the desert, looking at her and the buggy.
"What do you want?"
"I was looking for you. We're going to be working together, whether either one of us wants to or not. This isn't about who is the better programmer. It's about getting the assignment done."
He nodded.
"All right. We can stay out of each other's way."
Saturday, December 18th, 11:45 a.m., Chevy Chase, Maryland. Hughes had his Virgil, his virtual global interface link, in the limo, but he didn't want to use it to call Platt. There was a payphone just ahead, a landline, and as random as any. He directed his driver to pull over. He set the phone for Vox only, no vid, slipped the one-time throwaway scrambler over the mouthpiece, tapped in the number, let it ring once, then hung up. 30 seconds later, the phone rang. Unless it was a very large coincidence, that would be Platt.
"Okay, what's the situation?"
"Well, we got us a little problem here. Seems the Lord High Ooga Booga wants to see you face to face before he seals the deal."
Hughes ground his teeth together. Platt was a cracker, a racist. Sending him to Guinea-Bissau was an invitation to disaster. Platt was so white he gleamed, and 99% of the population in Guinea-Bissau was black.
"Anyway, what El Presidente said was, you don't come and sit down for a little chat, it's no deal."
Damn. Hughes fumbled for his electronic calendar, punched up the month of January, and looked at it.
"All right, tell President Paolo I will be there on January 13th. That's a Thursday."
"Thursday the 13th. I got it."
"And you come to Washington. I have other business for you."
Hughes opened the phone booth's door. A blast of cold wind hit him, raising chills on his neck. He could smell the snow coming. Better get back to the city before it turned the roads into parking lots. He nodded at the driver as he got back into the limo.
"Let's go home."
Monday, December 20th, 8:55 a.m., Washington, D.C. The invisible green-eyed demon had its claws sunk deep into Tyrone Howard's back, and it hurt like he wouldn't have believed only a couple of months ago.
Belladonna Wright was a year older than Tyrone, and without a doubt the most gorgeous young woman in D.C., on the East Coast, maybe in the whole world. And since he had done her a favor by helping her pass her computer class, they had gone to the mall, had done VR, and had sat in her bedroom and kissed until he thought he was going to explode. And there she stood, in her microskirt and halter top and squeegee slope plats, talking to another man.
"Uh-oh, looks like trouble in paradise,"
came the voice from behind him. Tyrone didn't have to look at the speaker. It was James Joseph Hatfield, a hillbilly from West Virginia who had such bad eyes he couldn't even wear contacts.
"Shut up, Jimmy Joe."
"Hey, no praw, Ryder. She's just talking to him, not fishing for his trouser eel."
Bella came toward him. People stopped to watch her. Queen of the hall, she swayed like a palm tree in a tropical breeze as she walked.
"I'm going to the mall after school if it doesn't snow again. You going?"
"Oh, yeah,"
Tyrone said.
"I plan to."
"Exemplary, Ty. See you at the shop."
He shook the trance. Jimmy Joe was asking about the revision to the net game he'd built and posted, Dino Wars.
"Oh, that. I haven't had much time to work on it."
He hurried towards his own first period class. And he was going to the mall after school. Dupe that to the eighth power. Monday, December 20th, 9:05 a.m. Quantico, Virginia. Julio Fernandez looked at the holo projection floating in the air behind the instructor.
"All right, who can tell me what the phrase security through obscurity means?"
Fernandez stared down at the screen built into the top of his desk. Pick somebody else, he thought. But at least the man was a civilian, and not, thank God, an officer. When it came to using his hands or his weapons, Fernandez didn't give away anything to anybody. He could set up camp in a jungle or a desert and live off the land, but when it came to anything past button-punching a computer, he was dense.
"Let me see. Sergeant Fernandez. Security through obscurity."
"Great. Just freaking great.
Sir, I believe it means that a certain kind of computer system security is sort of like a fortress. You know it is there, you can find it easy enough, but the doors into the place are armored or booby-trapped."
"Well, as it happens, by what is no doubt a major miracle, you are essentially correct."
Fernandez gritted his teeth. Even when he gave the right answer, this dipwit twisted it so he looked stupid. He was going to learn this crap if it killed him. So when the young shave-tail lieutenants started rattling off their compu-babble on a mission, he could nod and at least vaguely know what the hell they were talking about.
"So, who can tell us what happens when an electronic ticket expires on an encrypted access site? Sergeant Fernandez."
Fernandez was mightily tempted just to get up and walk out. His second choice was to get up and teach Horowitz how to breathe again after he punched him one good shot solidly in that soft gut.
"Come, come, Sergeant. Speed is of the essence. He who hesitates is lost and last."
Good thing he wasn't depending on getting some kind of grade in this class. He'd never pass. Fernandez stepped up to the desk, put his hands on it, and leaned towards the younger man.
"Listen up, sonny. You got the social skills and wit of a water buffalo. I'm an easygoing guy most of the time. That's why you aren't on your knees, observing the remains of your most recent meal spattered all over your shoes and the floor. I'm done here, Junior. I won't be back. Lucky for both of us."
He leaned back from the desk, smiled, and turned to walk away. Behind him, the instructor's voice was shrill, shading right up the scale and into soprano.
"What is your superior's name? I am going to report you for threatening me."
Fernandez turned, still smiling.
"My CO's name is Colonel John Howard. Give him my regards when you call. And I didn't threaten you, sonny. If I had done that, you'd be needing a fresh pair of pants. Adios."
Monday, December 20th, 10:05 a.m., Washington, D.C. Platt strolled along the sidewalk next to the mall in a T-shirt and jeans, without a jacket, pretending to ignore the hard chill and dirty, slushy snow the plows had piled up along the curb. It wasn't really all that cold, but he sure as hell felt it. Thing was, at 6'4 and 225, he didn't have any body fat to speak of, so no insulation. He didn't like Washington. Not the town, not the folks who lived and worked there, not the big old marble buildings. Wasn't nothing about it he liked. He looked at his watch. Just after 10. He grinned. About now, that spring-loaded time-release file would be hitting the web hard, and it was going to be like a ton of fresh feces whapping into a big old industrial-grade fan. If that bomb down in Louisiana didn't get their attention, this one would sure as hell wake them up. Ahead of him, coming in his direction, were two black men, African-Americans. Was that still what they called themselves? Call themselves anything they want. They were still darkies. They couldn't hide that. The two, in suits, stared at him, but they weren't right. A block or so later, he spotted the one he wanted. He was a big buck, wearing jeans and motorcycle boots, a leather jacket, and gargoyle shades, almost as big as Platt, and alone. He didn't like to carry a gun in the city unless he had particular need for one, and he didn't want to use the knife if it was one-on-one, unless the jig pulled one.
"Hey, what are you staring at, boy?"
The big black man stopped.
"Who you calling, boy, cracker?" "I don't see nobody else around, do you, boy?"
Leather Boy took his shades off and carefully slipped them into his pocket. He smiled. Platt matched the smile. Oh, this was going to be fun. Monday, December 20th, 10:20 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. Alex Michaels sat at his desk, looking over the latest computer dump into his electronic inbox. Somebody had stolen a couple million dollars worth of Intel's SuperPent wet light chips from a plant in Aloha, Oregon. Next item. Stanley the Scammer had opened a new VR store, once again selling porn. There was no product. He took their electronic money and shifted to a new location. Michaels shook his head, scrolled the proj. Here was a report of a money transfer gone bad at a small bank in South Dakota. It almost certainly was an inside job, given how good the Federal Reserve kept track of money these days.
"Sir,"
Liza broke in over the comm,
"I've got Don Siegel from the CIA on the hotline. He says it's an emergency."
"I'll take it."
"Alex, we got a big problem."
"I've got to appear before White's committee tomorrow morning. Bad as that?"
"I'm serious here, Alex. Somebody just posted to the net a list of all our Sub Rosa ops in the Euro-Asian theaters."
"Jesus."
"Yeah. Every American spy in Europe, Russia, China, Japan, Korea, all of them had just been outed."
"Damn."
"Yeah, damn. And think about it. If he got Europe, who's to say he didn't get the Middle East, Asia, or South America? We gotta find this guy, Alex."
"Yeah." Monday, December 20th, 10:25 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. Joanna Winthrop washed her hands, reached for the paper towel dispenser, and looked at her reflection in the large mirror over the sink in the women's restroom. All of her life, people had told her how beautiful she was. It was flattering. It was interesting. It got in her way. And it was a mystery to Winthrop. She was smart, she did well in school, stacked up well against objective academic standards, but nobody seemed to care about that. Being pretty was more important than being smart to everybody. Everybody except Joanna Winthrop. Her Virgil cheeped, and she pulled it from where it was clipped onto her belt. Incoming call. The caller ID showed it was Commander Michaels. It must be important if he was calling her from just down the hall.
"Yes, sir?"
"We have a situation here, Joanna. If you could come to my office, I'd appreciate it."
Monday, December 20th, 10:45 a.m. Michaels looked at the three leaders of his computer team.
"All right, folks, there it is. CIA is justifiably upset, and they'd like us to do something about it. Jay, what do we have so far?"
"I wish I could say it was good news, boss, but so far, zip city. I don't think we're dealing with some kid hacker, but I haven't found his footprints yet."
"Tony, how's he getting this stuff?"
"Three possibilities. One, he's cracking his way into secret files and stealing it. Two, somebody who knows it is feeding him. Or three, he knows it himself."
"So he could be almost anybody,"
Joanna said. "How do we stop him?"
Jay said, "We've already put out the word to all federal agencies to harden systems, change passwords, all like that. We set some rattle cans up on real obvious targets, but if he was dumb enough to blunder into those, he probably wouldn't have gotten in the first place."
Michaels nodded. It wasn't their fault, but they had to catch this guy before more people started dying. "Folks, this guy, whoever he is, has caused at least one death we know of, and maybe more. I want to see some operational scenarios that will nail this bastard and get him off the net. This is critical. Priority one. This sits on top of the pile. Understood? They nodded, murmured assent at him. All right. Go. Monday, December 20th, 12.05 p.m. Tony stretched her legs, dropping into the left sempak position. She looked up and saw Alex walk into the gym carrying his bag.
I didn't think I'd see you here, she said.
Me neither. He headed into the locker room, and Tony went back to limbering up. Of course, given her choice, she would be able to make his life a lot more relaxed away from work. He needed somebody to take care of him, to rub his back, fix him a drink before dinner, to... screw his brains out? Tony smiled. Well, yes, that too. That wasn't likely to happen. He was still faithful to his ex-wife, at least as far as Tony knew. She could hardly blame him if he wanted to chase the beautiful lieutenant, could she? Alex didn't feel for her how Tony felt for him. She loved him. Tony threw an elbow at an imaginary opponent. Too bad she couldn't control her love life as easily as she could a physical attack. Monday, December 20th, 2.05 p.m., Bladensburg, Maryland. Alone, Hughes drove to one of his safe houses for the meeting with Platt. There was always business that couldn't be handled long distance, just as in Guinea-Bissau, and one needed places to conduct such business away from curious eyes. Hughes drove a rental car, a small, plain gray Toyota something or other that looked just like a million other cars on the road. He wended his way through the vast parking lot, got lost when he took a wrong turn at one of the stupidly named and numbered lanes, Catbird 17, then finally arrived at the assigned parking slots for his apartment. He took the elevator to the third level, headed down the hall to the unit, opened the door with a plastic key card, and stepped quickly inside. Platt was already there. The big man had scratches and a brush burn on one cheek, and the knuckles on both hands were torn and crusted with flecks of dried blood.
"What the hell happened to you?"
Platt grinned.
"I had me a little argument with one of our underprivileged black brothers."
Hughes removed a thick manila envelope from his briefcase and tossed it at Platt, who caught it one-handed.
"There's 20,000 in there, all in used hundreds. Just be sure and get that list from the NSA satellite clerk."
"Yeah, I'm looking forward to those codes."
"What about the banks?"
"I got some stuff coming out on Wednesday. Nothing big, just a couple of thousand East Coast ATMs going wonky, giving out boku cash to anybody who uses a smart card."
"Anything else I need to know?"
"Nope. I got me an appointment with a masseuse this afternoon."
Hughes shook his head again. Platt didn't know it, but he'd been under surveillance for 6 weeks by a very discreet investigative firm hired to keep tabs on him. No doubt he would hear from his hired operatives about the street fight later, as he would hear about the masseuse who came to minister to Platt's needs. The woman would be black, of course. They always were. A wonderful dichotomy, Platt. He would beat up a black man in the morning, then fornicate with a black woman in the afternoon. Hypocrisy was such a wonderful thing, the world wouldn't be able to run without it.
"All right, I'll call when I have something else for you."
"I hear you,"
Platt said.
"See you later, alligator."
Tuesday, December 21st, 8:25 a.m., Washington, D.C. The Senate meeting room was too warm by at least 5 degrees, which certainly didn't help Alex Michaels feel any less sweaty. NetForce's budget was the only item on today's docket, and after a pretense at politeness, the charge, led by White, was in full attack. It was going to be a long day.
"Commander Michaels, are you trying to tell this committee that NetForce doesn't care if some nut makes public information about how to build bombs?"
"No, sir, Senator White. I did not say that." Michaels was beginning to get pissed off, and his reply was a little more clipped and sharp than it ought to be. Glenn Black, one of the FBI's top legal eagles, leaned over and whispered,
"Take it easy."
White went on.
"It sounds to me as though you're saying that NetForce has more important fish to fry, Commander."
Michaels knew that his boss, Walt Carver, the director of the FBI, was in the audience behind him. So far, Carver had been able to keep White at bay, but he was getting more aggressive all the time.
We are talking about issues of national security, about which I will not speak in public, but these are grave matters that NetForce is failing to address properly. What is the point of funding an agency that doesn't do its job, Commander Michaels?
I'm sure, Senator, that you know much more about agencies that don't do their job than I.
Michaels caught the warning look from Glenn, and it was easy enough to interpret. Easy, boy. Not smart. Michaels sighed. He had to watch his mouth. And even if he did, it was going to be a very long day. Tuesday, December 21st, 10 a.m., Dry Gulch, Arizona. Jay Gridley hadn't been disposed to spend that much time in the scenario, so he'd logged in on the edge of town. Black Rock had been a bust, no sign of the bad guys, so Gridley had moseyed on. He tipped his hat to an elderly woman in a long dress crossing the street.
"Howdy, ma'am."
The old lady gave him a suspicious glare and hurried on. A couple of boys chased barrel hoops down the dirt road, driving the flat metal rings with short sticks, laughing. Jay reined his horse, Buck, up in front of a sheriff's office. A gray-whiskered old man sat on a wooden chair, whittling on a big stick with a jackknife.
"You're looking for the sheriff. He ain't around."
"Where would I find him?"
"Boot Hill."
"There a deputy around?"
"Yep, planted right next to the sheriff."
"What's your name, old-timer?"
"Folks round here call me Gabby."
"Well, Gabby, I'm tracking down some shysters from back east. Bad hombres."
"Ain't been no tinhorn stop off here lately. Maybe some passing through on the stage. Wells Fargo offices down t'other end of town."
"I'm obliged, Gabby."
He was almost to the Wells Fargo depot when a big, swarthy, black-haired man with a drooping handlebar mustache and a pair of holstered guns stepped out into the street in front of him.
"Hold up there, pard."
There was a definite air of menace about the man, who wore a black suit over his boiled white shirt and tie and a derby hat instead of a cowboy outfit.
"I think maybe you need to turn around and head back where you came from."
The big man cleared his coat back from his holstered revolvers.
"It'd be good for your health."
"You got a name?"
"Bartholomew Dupree. Folks call me Black Bart."
Jay dropped his hand next to the butt of his colt.
"Sorry, Bart. I got business at the stage depot. Why don't you just stand aside and let me pass?"
"Can't do that, Marshal."
Definitely a firewall, and a tough one. So Jay was on the right track. His quarry had passed this way, and he wasn't about to give up because there was a roadblock. Bart went for his guns. He was fast, but Jay was faster. Jay uncocked, then holstered his gun, and walked over to where Bart lay on his side in the dirt. Got him right between the eyes.
"Teach you to mess with Lonesome Jay, pard."
He turned back, nodded at the soiled doves in the whorehouse, then headed for the stage depot. And after that, he was going to mosey on back to the sheriff's office and have a few words with old Gabby, the lion bastard. Tuesday, December 21st, 3:25 p.m., Washington, D.C. In his study at home, John Howard leaned back in his chair and glanced at his watch. He realized he was going to have to leave for the airport to pick up Nadine's mother in about 5 minutes. The idea of fighting rush-hour traffic made him feel even more tired than he already felt, which was plenty tired enough. He pushed away from the chair and stood. It wasn't going to do anybody any good sitting here thinking about being old. Not when his mother-in-law would turn into a black volcano spewing hot bile if he was late fetching her. Nadine was in the kitchen, working on supper, and Howard started in that direction. Might as well stir up Tyrone while he was at it. The boy was in his room, but instead of being glued to the computer chair like he usually was, he was lying on the bed, hands behind his head, staring at the ceiling. It was that girl, of course. Girls turned boys into adolescent beasts, struggling to crawl out of a mud pit of raging hormones. Abruptly, Tyrone sat up, then stood.
I'm going to the mall.
Howard felt a stab of anger.
Wait a second, mister. You don't tell me what you're doing. You ask.
Tyrone came to attention, executed a crisp, snappy salute, and said,
Yes, sir, Colonel Howard, sir.
For a few seconds, Howard didn't say anything. The rage abated just a hair, as he remembered he'd once been young and stupid himself. Adolescent angst.
All right, forget it. I'll get Nana. You go ahead to the mall.
No, I'll go with you to the airport. If I don't, Nana will blame you.
He grinned. Howard returned the grin. There Tyrone was, back at least for a moment. But Tyrone was only 13. They had 6 more years of this to look forward to.
Lord, Lord.
Tuesday, December 21st, 8:15 p.m., Washington, D.C. Naked, Platt lay on his stomach on the bed in the little hotel on C Street. The black woman, who was also naked, straddled the small of his back. She actually gave a pretty good massage, which was unusual for out-call girls.
"Damn, honey, you hot as a rock,"
she said, pressing hard with her thumb.
"You ain't seen the half of it, baby. Wait till I roll over."
She laughed.
"What line of work you in, Mr. Platt?"
"I'm an expediter. I travel a lot. Get to travel all over the world, making things happen. Maybe next time I get to Japan, I'll bring you back a souvenir."
"I like that. A nice red silk kimono."
Platt rolled over.
"My, would you look at that?"
She flashed even white teeth, bright against her chocolate skin.
"What do we have here?"
He slid his hands around under her butt and lifted her slightly.
"Hello, baby."
Tuesday, December 21st, 8:15 p.m., Washington, D.C. In his office, Hughes finished a synopsis of what he wanted White to say at his meeting with the vice president tomorrow. There was a knock at the door. Speak of the devil. White sauntered into the office and put a small package onto the desk.
"A Christmas present. You didn't think I'd forget, did you?"
Hughes smiled.
"Now how could I think that, Bob? I wrote the reminder in your day log myself."
Both men laughed. Hughes reached into the drawer and pulled out a Christmas-wrapped box and handed it to White.
"Can I open it?"
"Sure."
Eagerly, the senator ripped off the green and red foil and pulled the lid from the box. Inside the leathery cup was a game info ball, an iridescent silvery orb the size of a marble made to be slipped into a Sony Sega PlayStation. "That's the beta test full VR version of Dino Wars 2. Won't be generally available for a few more months."
"Really? Well, thanks, Tom."
White rolled the ball in his fingers, and Hughes could see he was itching to run home and play the game.
"I appreciate it. I truly do. Working with you has been so beneficial to me. I couldn't ever have gotten the job without you, Tom. Merry Christmas."
"Merry Christmas," Hughes said. "And with any luck at all," he thought, "the new year will be my best ever, though it might be your worst when the shit hits the fan."
Wednesday, December 22nd, 8:25 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. Alex Michaels wanted to keep the staff meeting short so they could get back to their desks. With Christmas only a few days away, not much work was getting done, as everybody geared up to go off for the holiday. He looked around the conference room at his primary players, Tony, Jay, Howard, and Joanna Winthrop. He already knew their plans, and no matter where they were, they'd keep grinding away at this thing.
"Anybody got anything new?"
"Nope. I got through the poster's firewalls, but the trail petered out. A dead end in a box canyon. I haven't been able to draw a bead on him since."
"All right, that's it. If one of you catches the poster before we take off for the holiday, I'd bet big that Santa Claus will put something nice in your stocking. A presidential commendation, at the least."
"Oh boy," Jay said. "A new floor for my parakeet's cage."
"I didn't know you had a parakeet,"
Tony said.
"I don't, but for that I'd get one."
Back at their offices, Tony approached Alex.
"Got a minute?"
"Sure."
In his office, she produced a small package, wrapped and decorated with a red bow.
"Merry Christmas."
"Thank you. Can I open it now?"
"Nope."
"Ah, intrigue. Here, I got you a little something."
She smiled at the wrapping, hefted it.
"Book?"
"Go ahead and open it."
She did. It was a 1972 first edition of Don F. Draeger's The Weapons and Fighting Arts of Indonesia.
"Where did you find this? It's a classic."
She was about to close the book when she got to the title page.
"Hey, it's autographed."
"Oh, really? Huh, how about that?"
The autograph had jacked the price of the book up a few $100. Impulsively, she hugged him. God, she felt good, pressed against him that way. There was a silence that started to get awkward. He said,
"So you're, going home to see your folks?"
"Yes, there'll be a big gathering. I hope your visit with Susie goes okay."
"Yeah."
"Well, I'd better get back to work. Thanks again for the book, Alex."
"You're welcome."
Thursday, December 23rd, 6:45 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. Joanna Winthrop took advantage of the takeoff work early offer from Commander Michaels to book a deadhead seat on an early military jet leaving from Quantico. Fernandez had offered to take her to the flight.
"I can catch a cab." "No problem, Lute. I'm heading out that way anyhow."
So now she rode in the front seat of Fernandez's personal car, a slate-gray 17-year-old Volvo sedan.
"I appreciate the lift." "No problem. You mind if I ask you something personal, Lieutenant?"
"Oh, Jesus, here it comes,"
she thought.
"He's going to hit on me. Has working with computers always been easy for you?"
That wasn't what she expected.
"Excuse me? You're good at it, that goes without saying, but you make it look easy. I mean, I've tried to learn, but I have this block. The information just bounces off."
"A thing can be told simply if the teller understands it properly."
"Excuse me? Okay, let's say you're on guard duty, you're watching a door. You open it when somebody with the right password comes by. You close it if they don't have the password. You follow that?"
"Sure.
Now you know how computers work. A door is open or it's closed. A switch is on or it's off. The answer is yes or no when somebody gets to the place you're standing guard."
"Well, how come nobody ever put it that way before?"
"Because you've run into crummy teachers before. A good teacher uses terms a student can relate to. All you need is a teacher who can put things in terms you already know. You're a soldier. Find a soldier who knows computers. You can learn from him."
"Or her."
"Why, are you asking me to teach you?"
"I would be ever so grateful if you would."
She smiled.
"This isn't some ploy to get next to me because you think I'm beautiful, is it, Fernandez?"
"No, ma'am. You have knowledge I don't have, and I'd like very much to learn it. I mean, yeah, you are beautiful, but what's more important here is that you're smart."
She blinked and looked at Fernandez in a new light. My God, if he was telling the truth, he admired her for her mind.
"Come see me when the holidays are over."
"Yes, ma'am."
"And bag that. Call me Joanna."
"I'll answer to just about anything, but my friends call me Sarge, or Julio."
"Julio it is."
Thursday, December 23rd, 4:10 p.m., in the air over southern Ohio.
"Would you care for something to drink, sir?"
Alex Michaels looked up from the in-flight magazine.
"A Coke."
He poured the soft drink into his cup, then sat and watched it fizz and foam. He was in business class. The equipment was one of the big Boeing 777s, and he sat next to the wing door on the starboard side. He liked to get that seat when he could, next to the exit door. Of course, he'd rather fly first class. A couple of times he had gotten agency upgrades on official business, and it was more comfortable, but he could never justify the expense when it came to personal flights. The way he figured it, the back of the plane got there at the same time as the front did. The airlines had gotten a lot better about not losing luggage, but he wasn't taking any chances. He had his single soft side roller tucked into the overhead compartment, along with Susie's main Christmas gift, a band Vox synthesizer. Apparently, she had discovered a kind of music called techno-meto-funk, which was all the rage among the kids. There was a spare bedroom in the big old clunky two-story house, two if you counted the sewing room, but Megan hadn't offered, and he hadn't asked. The armistice between Alex and his ex was uneasy. She was a sniper, quick to shoot, and too accurate for his comfort. Better to have a safe house where he could hold up and gather his forces for the battle. Certainly this wasn't a place he had ever foreseen for himself when he'd been courting Megan. When they'd been young, in love, with the world by the tail, so full of themselves they could never envision failing at anything, much less their marriage. Boy, that had been a long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Thursday, December 23rd, 5:15 p.m., Washington, D.C. The car was small, black, and looked like an old Fiat. The driver heard the siren behind him and pulled over. The Fiat's door opened, and a smallish man in a long dark coat stepped out of the car. A pair of policemen approached, pistols drawn. The uniforms they wore had that Middle European look, odd-shaped billed caps with checkering on the front, leather jackets over dark blue shirts and ties, and dark blue trousers with a yellow seam stripe on the outside of the legs. The small man ran. The cops' guns belched orange fire and white smoke, and the empty shells showered the car. The small running man fell, face down, on the street. He moved his arms and legs as if trying to swim on the concrete. One of the cops moved to where the small man lay on the street. He pointed his pistol at the back of the downed man's head. He fired. Thomas Hughes blew out a big sigh, leaned back in his chair, and looked at the frozen hollow projection. He felt a flash of regret, but he buried it. The man was a spy. Hughes had gotten the recording from one of his spies, actually one working for Platt. And it was brutal to watch, a man getting murdered like that, but there it was. You couldn't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. What were a few spies, easily replaced, compared to the long-range goals Hughes had in mind? The stakes were high, and the cards had to be played correctly, or the game would be lost. It was a pity about this agent, and about the others who would be imprisoned, or maybe killed, but there was no way around it. His comm cheeped. It was the secret number, rerouted through something like 16 satellite bounces so it couldn't be traced to him. He checked the scrambler and clicked on the vox-altering circuit, picking old lady for the latter. Whoever was on the other end would hear what sounded like a 90-year-old woman talking.
Hello?
I have some information concerning certain shipments. Hughes knew who it was. A mid-level manager at the National Security Agency, a man with top-secret clearance, but a man who had a secret gambling problem. It concerns some volatile minerals. I need 50,000.
How much of the volatile substance are we talking about?
19 pounds.
This is a domestic movement.
Two are foreign.
When?
In 2 days.
All right. I'll have somebody meet you at the place tonight, 9 p.m. Bring the information.
Hughes broke the connection. He tapped his comm. Platt answered right away.
Swing by here, now.
He would give Platt the money and send him to fetch the information. There were a lot of groups out there who would pay millions to get their hands on 19 pounds of weapons-grade plutonium. You didn't need that much to build yourself a nice and dirty little nuclear bomb. It would make a hell of a bang when you set it off. Now he could really give Netforce something to think about. Friday, December 24th, 11 a.m., the Bronx, New York. Tony climbed the familiar brownstone steps, steps that she had swept clean daily when she'd been studying with Guru De Beers. As she reached up to knock, the old woman's gravel and smoke voice came from within.
"Not locked. Come in."
Tony grinned. She was sure the woman was psychic. At 80-something years old, Guru was still brick-shaped and solidly built, but frailer and slower than she had been. As always, her clean and carefully set white hair smelled slightly of ginger from the shampoo she used.
"Welcome home, Tunanganya."
Tony smiled. Best girl, what Guru had called her almost since they'd met.
"Coffee in a minute."
Guru waited until most of the water filtered through, then added a bit more. She repeated this until the kettle was empty.
"So, how is life in Washington? Has your young man yet seen the light?"
"Not yet, grandmother."
Guru sipped her coffee and nodded.
"He will. All men are slow, some slower than others."
"I wish I could be sure of that."
"If he fails to notice you properly, he does not deserve you."
They drank more coffee. When they were almost done, Guru said,
"I think it is time to tell you a story about my people. My father's father's father came from Holland on a sailing ship in 1835. Back then, the country was not called Indonesia. To my people, our island was Java. In due course, my grandfather was born. When my grandfather had 11 summers, my great-grandfather sailed back to Holland
to rejoin his wife and children there, now a wealthy man. He left his Javanese family well provided for, not always the custom with white men, but he never saw or contacted them again. My grandfather's mother's brother, Bapa, the wise, took it upon himself to teach my grandfather, whose Dutch name was Willem, how to be a man, and eventually he became a soldier, part of the native army. Go into my bedroom and look at the nightstand. There is a thing upon a small silk pillow there. Bring it to me.
On the nightstand was a red pillow, and upon the pillow was a kris inside a wood and brass sheath. Tony knew what it was. She had played with plenty of knives. Guru traded the weapon for her empty coffee cup, which Tony quickly refilled.
My great-uncle Bapa had no sons, only daughters, and when it came time for my grandfather to become a man and receive his kris, this is the one he inherited.
The old woman drew the knife from the wooden sheath and held it up.
Some believe a good kris could kill slowly an enemy simply by stabbing his shadow, or even his footprints. If an enemy approached, a good kris would rattle in its sheath to warn its owner of danger. The sight of the naked blade would turn a hungry tiger in its tracks. My grandfather gave this to my father when he became a man, and my father gave it to my only brother when he became a man. I bore my husband 3 sons and a daughter. 2 of my sons live, and I have 6 grandsons and a great-grandson. But of all my family, none have studied the arts.
The old woman held the dagger out on the palms of her hands to Tony. Tony knew this was no small thing for Guru, and she had no thought for refusing. She kneeled in front of the old woman and took the weapon in both of her hands.
Thank you, Guru. I am honored.
Tony looked down at the smooth wood of the sheath. Why was Guru giving this to her now? She had a sudden chill.
Guru, you aren't... I mean, your health isn't...
The old woman laughed.
No, I'm not ready to leave just yet. Tell me more of this young man who has yet to recognize your spirit. Maybe together we can find a way to wake him.
Saturday, December 25th, 6:30 a.m., Alexandria, Virginia. Julio Fernandez went to early mass at St. Gerard's. He was on duty and couldn't fly back for Christmas with the relatives. Well, that wasn't strictly true. He could have gotten leave because he had seniority, but there were other men with families locally who needed the time more than he did, so he had volunteered. It wasn't as if Mama was going to be rattling around in her house alone. Still, she wanted to hear from her children who couldn't get there, and the first question she would ask him after how he was doing would be, had he gone to Mass this morning? So he'd get a few points for this. Assuming he didn't doze off on the pew, sleep all day, and completely miss calling home. Saturday, December 25th, 7 a.m., Boise, Idaho. Alexander Michaels rang the doorbell of the house that had once been his. It was a big wooden 2-story home built in the early 1900s at the top of a slight rise, with a high front porch at the top of 10 broad steps. He heard his daughter's footsteps and her yelling as she raced for the door.
Daddy's here! Daddy's here!
Hey, Squirt. How are you?
Great, great! Come in! We've all been waiting on you to open presents!
We've all been waiting on you? Did she mean herself, Megan, and the dog Scout? Sure enough, little Scout, the poodle who thought he was a wolf, came sliding around the corner from the kitchen. As he stood, the little dog licking his face, Megan stepped into the hall from the living room.
Come on in. Susie is about to pop.
Michaels put the dog down and followed his ex-wife into the living room. Standing by the old plush blue couch was a stranger, a big man with a full beard. He wore jeans and a blue work shirt and cowboy boots. Megan slipped her hand under his arm, smiled at him, then turned back to look at Michaels and said,
Byron, this is Alex Michaels, Susie's father. Alex, this is my friend Byron Baumgartner. He's a teacher at Susie's school.
The big man grinned, showing nice white teeth, and ambled over to take Michael's hand. Michaels felt sick. He wished the ground would open up and swallow him. He wanted to be anywhere on the planet instead of here. Saturday, December 25th, 11 a.m., Bethesda, Maryland. On his back, on the bench, Platt squared himself under the weight. 440 pounds. The two gym rats moved in a hair and put their hands under the end of the bar, not touching it, but ready, just in case. The first rep went up pretty easy. Second rep was a little harder, but he got it to lock out. The third rep was hard. He knew his limits.
I'm done. Take it.
The two bodybuilders caught the ends and helped him re-rack the barbell. Platt headed for the chinning rack. He didn't take anything but vitamins and a few aminos and supplements, so he didn't have to worry about his liver rotting or getting brain cancer or shit like that. His sweats were already soaked, but he figured he could do a couple sets of chins and dips, no weight, alternating, to finish off his pump. Half an hour in the sauna and hot tub, a shower, and he was done. He wondered if that bento place over on Wisconsin was open today. A couple plates full of grilled chicken skewers and rice with hot and sweet sauce would sure taste good about now. He'd go check it out. Saturday, December 25th, noon, Sugarloaf Mountain, Boulder, Colorado. The big fire, roaring away, pushed the cabin's chill into the room's corners.
Merry Christmas,
Joanna Winthrop said. She raised her champagne glass.
Same to you,
Maudie said. They drank.
This is great, Winthrop said. It ought to be. It cost me $80 a bottle. So tell me more about this sergeant. What's his name? Anything serious in the offing? Too early to tell. So far all we've talked about is computers. But he seems like a sweet man, and he admires me for my mind. No, I have a good feeling about this one. How many men have you met who will admit they don't know something about everything? So far? Let me see, oh, if you total them up, about roughly approximately none. So I'm one up on you.
They drank. They laughed some more. There were worse ways to spend Christmas. Saturday, December 25th, 3:15 p.m., Ambush Flats, Arizona. Jay Gridley was getting a little tired of the Western scenario. At the moment, he was in the small town of Ambush Flats, walking up toward the telegraph office.
Any messages for Marshal Gridley come through here?
No, sir, I don't believe they have.
The man made a show of checking the stack of yellow paper next to his key.
Nope, don't see none.
And any messages a marshal ought to know about pass through your ears or fingers?
No, sir, I'm a law-abiding citizen, Marshal. I don't truck with such things.
Jay left the telegraph office and moseyed around to the back of the building. There was a wooden barrel of trash next to the door. He pulled a Strike Anywhere Lucifer from his shirt pocket, scratched it on the barrel's metal hoop, and tossed the flaring match into the trash. Paper caught, flamed, and in a few seconds there was a hot little fire blazing away in the barrel.
Fire!
Somebody yelled. A bell started to ring. Folks came a-running, too. The telegrapher sprinted through the front door of the office, and Jay sauntered back into the building. He used his Barlow jackknife to slip the simple lock so he could get at the hidden documents in the drawer. Technically speaking, what he was doing wasn't altogether legal, but he wasn't going to use it in court. He was just looking for information. Looked like a waste of time again. Hello? What was this? Jay read the message, growing more alarmed as he went. Somebody had sent particulars on the routes for 4 shipments of plutonium, and the stuff was moving today.
Holy shit.
Clutching the message tightly, Jay ran. Saturday, December 25th, 1:25 p.m., Boise, Idaho. Megan was making it perfectly clear by the way she kept touching, leaning, or rubbing against Byron exactly what she wanted her ex-husband to know. He was supposed to stay for lunch, and if he hadn't thought it would upset Susie, he would have already bailed and gone back to his hotel. His Virgil cheeped. He checked the caller ID, Jay Gridley.
What's up, Jay?
Chief, we got a major problem here. Somebody just tried to hijack 4 shipments of plutonium.
Why is this our problem?
Because the message giving times and places came out of a NetForce workstation, Chief, right here in HQ.
Oh, shit.
Michaels looked up and saw Megan frowning at him from the hall.
Something has come up. I'm going to have to miss lunch. Sorry.
Big surprise. Her voice was bitter. Susie came out of her music trance.
What? You're leaving? You just got here.
Daddy's work is more important than staying to visit, honey. Michaels glared at Megan. Then he looked at his daughter.
I'm sorry, baby, but it's an emergency.
It's okay, I understand.
But she didn't understand. He could see that. And Megan wasn't going to make it any easier. And it hurt, just like she knew it would. She knew how to find the cracks in his armor. He said, his voice tight,
I'm doing the best I can.
Hey, take it easy there, Byron said.
Michaels looked at the big bearded man as if he had just turned into a giant upright toad.
Why don't you go get some more firewood, Byron? This is a private conversation.
Megan flared at that. Anything you can say to me, you can say in front of Byron.
You can really be a bitch when you want, you know.
That got her attention. It got Byron's attention, too.
That's it, pal. You're out of here.
He reached out and grabbed Michael's arm with both hands. Boy, was that the wrong thing to do. Michaels reacted without thinking. He swung his elbow at Byron's head, keeping it in tight, just like Tony had taught him. Bone met bone with a solid thwack, and Byron fell as if his legs had suddenly vanished. Megan dropped to her knees and grabbed at the fallen man.
Byron, Byron, are you okay?
He'd live. He was just stunned. Megan looked up from the fallen man.
We're getting married, and Byron wants to adopt Susie.
Congratulations. I'll send you a toaster, but he will adopt Susie over my dead body.
With that, he turned and stalked out. In the cold air, snow clouds gathered and threatened.
Perfect. Just perfect. You wanted an excuse to leave.
But he couldn't believe what he had just done, how he had lost control.
Damn.
Compared to what he just felt, terrorists stealing nuclear material didn't seem so bad.
Saturday, December 25th, 4:45 p.m., Tonopah, Arizona. Michaels rode in the second helicopter of his trip, heading for the hijacking site on Interstate 10, about 40 miles west of Phoenix. John Howard had flown out in one of NetForce's chartered 747s with his strike team and had set up a command post at a truck stop just outside Tonopah, Arizona. The ground was a beehive of activity. Cars, trucks, troops, flashing lights. Michaels exited the craft and walked to where Howard stood.
How's it going?
This way, sir.
A chilly wind blew across the dry land, but inside the mobile tactical unit, a fiberglass-framed tent the size of a small house, the air was warm. A dozen techs worked on various electronics, mostly computers and comm gear. Howard stopped in front of a big flat screen on a stand.
Somebody sent the routing information for 4 shipments of plutonium scheduled to move today to a paramilitary group that calls itself the Sons of Patrick Henry. Here are the sites.
Red dots pulsed on the map. France, Germany, Florida, and Arizona.
All 4 went off simultaneously. We got word to the convoys ASAP. The Florida and German convoys took alternate routes and encountered no problems. We alerted the French authorities. They got there in time to stop the assault. We called the Army Transport Group here too late. By the time the National Guard and state boys and girls showed up, it was all over. They left behind a couple of anti-tank mines to slow pursuit. The State Patrol lost 2 cruisers and 3 officers. 5 civilian cars also got blasted.
Where do we stand?
We know who did it. We know where they are. It's just north of Gila Bend Indian Reservation, not that far from here. These people apparently own property all over the country, and they've got branches all over the world. We got the place footprinted with 1 K-1 Albatross spy sat.
This is where you think they took the plutonium?
GPS puts it in the southwest corner of this building, right there.
Where's the army?
They're massing their teams 30 miles south of the bolt hole, on the old Luke Air Force target range.
What are our options, the tactical considerations, if we get the nod?
Howard flashed a tiny grin, teeth bright against his chocolate skin.
Fast and dirty. We can give the Air Force a call. They can drop a big smart rock that'll squash the Sun's flat before they ever know it's coming. End of immediate problem.
course, that could spread the plutonium dust all over the surrounding countryside, which might upset the locals.
You don't see any possibility of negotiation here?
No, sir. We're talking everything from treason to multiple murder to a dozen other local, state, and federal felonies. Their manifesto is, give me liberty or give me death. And we can't dick around long enough to let them think about things they might do with that heavy metal they borrowed.
You don't think they've booby-trapped the container?
No, sir, I don't. They haven't had time to think about it much. I see an infantry-style assault in the dark as our best bet. Since these guys are gun nuts, they've probably got spook eyes and motion detectors, but we can get close enough to knock those out and be on top of them before they have time to figure out what's happening.
What if they have heavier weapons? Rockets, AP, like that.
We got half a dozen jump troops who can use parasails well enough to hit a spot the size of a dinner plate from 6,000 feet at night. I've got green hats, black hats, SEALs, the best of the best on this team. Those camo clowns won't know what hit 'em, no matter what they're shooting.
You want this one, Colonel?
Again, the smile. Larger this time. Yes, sir. You bet.
I'll call the director and see what the situation is.
Howard watched as Michaels moved off to a quieter part of the tent to use his Virgil. Did he want this operation? Shit, he couldn't imagine anything he could want more just at the moment.
Sir, we got the second bird coming online, about to step on the location, Fernandez said.
Put it on the holoprod so we can get a 3D view.
As the colonel orders.
A two-story ranch house sat in the middle of the compound, which was surrounded by a chain-link fence, probably 10 feet high. There was also what looked like a wooden barn and a smaller storage building behind the house. Four trucks, two cars, and a single-engine high-wing airplane were parked in front of the main house. There were two guards on the gate with rifles or carbines slung over their shoulders and holstered sidearms. A third guard with a large dog patrolled the fence in the back.
"We have any idea how many are in there, Julio?"
Fernandez drifted over and shook his head.
"No, sir. Most we've seen at times half a dozen, four men and two women. No children, thank God."
Michaels came back, clipping the Virgil onto his belt, next to his taser. Howard raised his eyebrows.
"It's ours, Colonel."
Howard grinned, real big.
"Colonel, Merry Christmas. I hope it doesn't blow up in our faces."
Saturday, December 25th, 9 p.m., Bladensburg, Maryland. Hughes had just walked into the safe house apartment when his Virgil buzzed. He looked at the ID. Senator White.
"Hello, Bob. Merry Christmas. Tom, what's all this I've been hearing about some kind of nuclear material getting stolen?"
"My sources tell me the leak came from Net Force headquarters."
"I'll have Michael's head on a platter if that's true."
"It'll keep until after the holidays, Bob."
"All right, if you say so."
Platt swaggered in.
"Give my love to June and the girls."
"I will. Merry Christmas, Tom."
Platt walked to the refrigerator, opened it, and took out a plastic bottle of apple juice.
"Seems like such a waste, telling the sons of whoever about all the shipments, then telling the feds on them."
Hughes shook his head. Platt was definitely a loose cannon. Sooner or later, he was going to shoot the wrong way, or blow himself and everything around him into bloody pieces.
"What about the guys guarding the uranium? He don't feel like they're dead because of you?"
"I didn't pull any triggers. I didn't tell anybody else to, either. Our goal here is not to blow things up."
"I hear you."
"Good.
I think it's time the subversive group responsible for all these problems on the net steps up to claim credit. Let's show them the manifesto."
Platt grinned.
"I've been waiting to do this."
"Don't embellish it, Platt. Just like I wrote it."
"No prob, boss. It's bad enough without me fiddling with it."
A loose cannon with a short fuse. If Hughes didn't deactivate him soon, Platt was going to screw the whole thing up. A couple more weeks, a month, they'd be over the hump, and Platt was going to have a fatal accident. Maybe just disappear. Saturday, December 25th, 9:35 p.m., in the air over southern New Jersey. Tony sat on the left side of the commuter jet, staring into the dark over the ocean in the distance. Jay Gridley's call had come as a surprise, but it wasn't such a great loss that she had to leave the annual gathering a little early. She loved her family, but after a couple of days cooped up in the apartments with them, things could get a little contentious. It surprised her, too, that Alex had cut short his visit home to fly from Boise to Arizona. He wasn't a field operative, and she worried about him. John Howard wouldn't let Alex do anything dangerous, she hoped, but it still gave her butterflies, thinking about Alex being on site for a hot op. He should be back at HQ, and the strike team should be doing its job without him. She leaned back in the seat and stared through the window. The jet was half empty. Not a lot of people traveling on Christmas Day. Saturday, December 25th, 11:15 p.m., Sugarloaf Mountain, Boulder, Colorado. Sitting in the propane-heated spa set into the redwood deck behind the cabin, Joanna and Maudie watched the snow fall into the hot water and melt. Winthrop took another sip from the second bottle of champagne they'd bought, splurging their own money for the good vintage after they'd polished off Maudie's admirer's gift. Maudie raised her glass and watched a few snowflakes hit the wine. She said, "Problem with this is that you get spoiled real quick. After the expensive stuff, the cheap champagne tastes like something you'd clean your oven with." From inside the cabin, a calm chirped, a 1-2-3 rhythm.
"That's mine," Winthrop said.
"Damn, don't answer it." She considered it for a moment.
"Nah, I better. Could be my family."
Winthrop stepped out of the water and padded through the snow to where a pair of thick beach towels hung on a rack next to the doors.
"Damn, girl, if I was into women, you'd be my first choice," Maudie said. "You got a great butt. Speaking strictly as somebody who knows how much work it takes to get one to look like that, of course."
Winthrop grinned.
"Beauty is only skin deep. Yeah, but a great butt is a joy forever."
The caller ID showed the name Lonesome J. Gridley. She listened as he filled her in on the situation with the terrorists' attacks on nuclear transport.
"I'll catch the next plane I can back to HQ."
"That isn't necessary. I believe we can get along without you for a couple more days."
"What aren't you telling me, Gridley?"
"That leak I mentioned that seemed to come from inside NetForce?"
"Yes."
"It came from your station." "Talk to you later."
He discalmed. Winthrop stared at her calm as if it were a rat come to life in her hand.
"Oh, man, this sucked."
Sunday, December 26th, 1:50 a.m., Gila Bend, Arizona. Howard looked around. His strike team troops were loaded in three transport vehicles, and they were parked in a dusty stretch of desert with a slightly overcast sky. Probably the stealth shells wouldn't even be necessary. So far, there hadn't been any radar signature emitted from the ranch, so maybe the terrorists hadn't had time to get a unit, or if they had, to set it up. Each of the vehicles held six troopers, suited, locked, and loaded. Except for the LOSER headsets, line-of-sight infrared tactical comms, the strike team would keep radio silence until after they had secured the objective. And since LOSER signals were encrypted, even if the terrorists had a full-range scanner, they wouldn't get anything but gibberish. Weapons of choice were H&K 9mm subguns and H&K tactical pistols. Howard himself carried a much more unofficial weapon, a 1928 Thompson 45 caliber submachine gun that had belonged to his grandfather. Normally, he'd be using a 30 caliber assault rifle, a 7.62, but like the S&W revolver strapped to his right hip, the Tommy gun was a good luck piece, an old but still functional good luck piece. His antique revolver and Chicago typewriter notwithstanding, whoever these camo clowns were, they didn't have the state-of-the-art combat gear that NetForce had. Howard looked at his watch.
"The transport plane will be entering the drop zone in 33 minutes. It's running whisper props, but even so, out here sound carries. We've had a series of spy sats providing continual footprints of the area, so we pretty much know where every terrorist is. We'll have continual coverage through the expected duration of the attack, and a little longer, too, just in case things don't go quite as planned. Alpha Team will hit the main building with flashbangs, while Beta Team covers the rear of the house, the barn, and the storage shed. Delta Team will patrol outside what's left of the fence."
Howard glanced at his watch again.
"All right, people, this is it. Let's roll."
"Good luck, Colonel. Give him hell."
"Thank you, sir. We will."
Fernandez slid his helmet visor down and clicked his spook eyes on, then cranked the engine and moved out.
Howard picked up his computerized helmet from the floor by his feet and slipped it on, put the visor down, and lit his own night vision scope. He buckled his 3-point seatbelt into place, snapping the black steel latch shut with a hard clack.
"Will you look at that?"
Fernandez said.
"Bugs Bunny!"
A jackrabbit angled across their path, then cut sharply back and stopped as the Humvee rolled past. It sat there watching as the cruisers also zipped past, turning its head to track them. Alex Michaels walked back to the 4-wheel drive they'd given him, a little Subaru Outback. The strike team was out of sight in the darkness, heading for a rendezvous with the bad guys 10 miles away. He should have stayed at the Tent HQ, back at the Texaco truck stop in Tonopah, but even if he wasn't a frontline soldier, he had wanted to come at least this far. He started the car, headed back to the dirt road a mile or so away that would take him to the highway a couple miles past that. It was really dark out here, the only source of illumination his headlights, and he bounced along for what seemed a lot longer than a mile. He reached the dirt road. For just a moment, he wasn't sure about which way to turn. Alex paused, then made up his mind. There was no danger, he knew, not to himself, nor to Colonel Howard's strike team. The terrorist camp was several miles away, at least 4 or 5, so he could head this way for a couple of miles. The road dipped into a gully, came up, and he rolled over several half-buried rocks in the dirt, jolting him hard enough so his head nearly hit the roof. He didn't remember that part of the drive coming in. None of it looked familiar. Dark as it was, he couldn't see anything but what was in the cone of his headlights, but surely he should have reached the highway by now. Michaels shook his head. Brother, wouldn't that be a story for the folks at HQ? You heard about how Commander Michaels got lost in the desert? A man stepped out of the scrub growth. He wore chocolate-chip desert camouflage pants and a jacket, and held a short assault weapon in his hands, pointed at Michaels' car. He waved the weapon, his meaning clear, pull over. An AK-47? Fear spasmed in Michael's belly as he realized who this must be. It was one of the terrorists. Oh, shit. What had he done? Better still, what was he going to do now? 2:24 a.m., Gila Bend, Arizona. Howard looked at his watch.
Ready to rock, Sergeant?
Just call me Elvis.
The compound was just ahead, a smear of hard yellow flaring in the spook eye's optical field from the security light mounted high on the wall of the barn, which illumination should be going out just about. Now the compound went dark.
Better make sure your filters are up, Colonel. The light show is about to begin.
Time slowed for Alex Michaels as the gunman walked toward his car. In what couldn't have been more than a couple of seconds, Alex sorted through all the possibilities he could think of. He could try to talk his way out of it. He could stomp the gas pedal and haul ass. He could pull his taser. He could shit or go blind. The gunman got to within a foot or two of the door.
Choose, Alex. Choose!
Gate, dead ahead, Fernandez yelled. Looks like our sappers have taken it down along with the guards.
Alpha has landed, came a voice over Howard's loser. We're in the door.
Beta's got the back,
came another voice.
Delta's on patrol,
came a third. Fernandez slewed the Humvee to a stop by the shed where the chickens were kept. Howard bailed out, the Thompson held ready.
Damn!
Howard turned, saw a man and a woman in the doorway to the barn, illuminated by the bright yellow-orange of their muzzle flashes as they fired bursts from fully automatic rifles at him and Fernandez. A bullet hit Howard on the torso. It felt like being whacked with a hammer.
Shit!
Michaels yanked the latch up, threw his weight against the door, and slammed it into the surprised gunman. It wasn't enough to knock him down, but it did rock him off balance. But he quickly recovered enough to swing the assault rifle around. Michaels pulled the door shut, thrust the taser through the open window, and fired the weapon. The man jerked, juttered toward the car as the capacitor needles fed him however many thousand volts they held. The assault rifle nosed skyward and went off 5 or 6 times in one long noise, blat, flashing red-orange and making less noise than it seemed it should. Michaels exhaled, his held breath. Howard looked at the man and woman who had opened up on him and Fernandez.
They weren't using concealment or cover, just standing there, hosing. So Howard V-stepped hard to his left, brought the Thompson up to a quick kill point, and triggered a 5-round burst at the man. Without waiting to see the effect, he shifted his index to the woman. Brrrap! The shooters collapsed, and the man beat the woman to the ground by maybe a half second. "We have the objective," Alpha's team leader said over the Loser. Howard blew out a big breath.
"Copy, Alpha. Good work. Doc, Julio took one in the leg. Get over that PDQ."
30 seconds later, Delta Team's vehicle, empty except for the driver, Doc, plowed right through a section of fence, slapped it flat, and skidded to a stop 10 feet away. Doc flicked his helmet spotlight on and used a suit cutter to open a big flap in the leg of the wounded sergeant's armor.
"Looks like a 20-caliber high-velocity hardball. Missed the bone, no expansion. I don't see any problem."
Howard nodded, relieved.
"Let's hear it, people."
The reports came in.
"A walk in the park, sir," Alpha's team leader said. "Objective is patent, no leaks, BG radiation levels normal. Send Doc on in when he gets a minute."
Howard blew out a sigh. They had the stolen nuclear material, and Julio was going to be okay. It could have been a lot worse. Time to call Michaels.
"Commander?"
"Colonel, everything okay?"
"Yes, sir. Objective achieved, terrorist neutralized. Sergeant Fernandez picked up a little scratch."
"Outstanding, Colonel. Congratulations. Please pass it on to your team."
"Thank you, sir. We'll see you at Field HQ as soon as we get things cleaned up here."
"I'm on my way there now."
"Sir, you aren't there yet?"
I took a little ride in the country. I picked up a hitchhiker you might find interesting to talk to when you get back. I'll explain it when I see you."
"Sir, discom."
After he signed off, Howard considered his relationship with Commander Alexander Michaels. He wasn't bad for a civilian. Not bad at all.
"Can we hurry this up and go home, sir?" Fernandez said. "I have an early tango lesson I don't want to miss."
Howard laughed. Monday, December 27th, 1:30 p.m., Washington, D.C. Tyrone Howard thought he might just go Nova, might just shatter into a million billion pieces. He sat on Bella's bed, his arms around her, and they kissed. Her back felt hot under his hands, even through her shirt, and there wasn't a strap across her smooth skin. She broke the kiss and let out a big sigh.
"You have to leave now, Tyrone."
"Uh-huh."
He leaned in and kissed her again.
"No, really, Tyrone, I have to go."
"Uh-huh."
Finally, she pulled away again and said,
"I'll see you at the mall tomorrow. You duplicate?"
She took his hand in both hers, kissed it on the palm, then pressed it against her left breast. His mouth fell open. His brain went into vapor lock. He stood, knowing what a zombie must feel like. Explode. He was going to just blow up and splatter all over the room. It would make a big, gooey mess. How could he not? He couldn't stand it. Monday, December 27th, 2 p.m., Quantico, Virginia. Julio Fernandez was in what passed for the infirmary at HQ. He looked at the time sig on the TV screen. He'd come back from the raid and been examined at noon. So he was stuck here until noon tomorrow. Boredom and cafeteria food loomed and threatened. Jesus. A nurse came in, and with her was the colonel. He grinned real big.
"How's the leg?"
"Fine. I could take you on the obstacle course right now."
"I'd almost rather be doing that than going home."
"Your mother-in-law still there?"
"Until next Sunday."
"Serves you right, sir."
By the time she got back to HQ, Joanna Winthrop knew the party was over. The terrorists had been taken down, the stolen plutonium recovered, and the only thing she had to do now was figure out who had gotten into her workstation and used it to give the sons of whoever the information about the shipments. Somebody had told her that Julio Fernandez had been shot and was in the infirmary.
"Sergeant Fernandez?"
"Lieutenant Winthrop."
"I heard you got shot."
"A scratch.
So how you doing?
I heard about the workstation business."
"Oh, don't worry about that. I'll figure it out."
"Any suspects?"
"At the top of my list, Jay Gridley. He doesn't like me. He thinks I slept my way into this job."
"Seriously? That he thinks I used my feminine wiles, or that he planted the leak in my station? Yes to the former, no to the latter."
There was a moment of quiet where neither of them spoke.
"So, How was it?
She asked.
The sortie. Oh, the bad guys weren't in our league. They were outsmarted, outmaneuvered, and outgunned.
Too bad I missed it.
You been on a few field ops?
Nothing lately. The colonel thinks I'm more useful in front of a computer.
He's right. Grunts like me are a dime a dozen, but a computer genius is harder to replace.
She smiled.
Anything I can do for you?
She saw him hesitate a second, wondered if there would be an off-color remark. If he was looking for an opening, this was a good one. He shook his head.
No, ma'am, but thank you for asking. See you when I get out.
He flashed her a nice smile. Jay Gridley had given up on the cowboy scenario because it felt too slow, so now he turned to one of his favorite action heroes, borrowing from one of the early classic James Bond movies, Thunderball. Over the landscape he flew, zipping through the air with the famous Bell rocket belt on his back. The original rocket belt was essentially nothing more than a pair of fuel tanks, some handlebars, a throttle, and a couple of rocket nozzles. Jay's version had a secret but theoretically possible fuel and a miniature jet engine that gave him an hour in the air and an automatic safety reserve to allow him to land when the fuel ran low. Right at the moment, Jay was zooming over the new 16-lane South China Causeway from just outside Zhangang, Hong Kong, heading north to Zhuilong on the mainland, looking for Wong Electronic Trucks. Wong Electronics made some minor pieces of hardware, but they specialized in transmission software, readers and mailers, and certain kinds of security programs. Whoever had snuck into Winthrop's computer had erected a couple of firewalls and dug two deadfalls on his or her way out to cover his or her ass, and from the size and shape, even without the snipped-off ID codes, Jay knew the walls and falls were top-of-the-line Wongware. There was one of the orange-roof trucks now, a couple hundred feet below and half a mile ahead. He throttled back on the belt's thrust and started to lose altitude. He achieved the rear of the truck, shucked off the jetpack, and got out his lockpicks. It took him 45 seconds to get the door open. From 1,000 feet above Jay Gridley, Platt watched, holding slow and level the helicopter he found himself flying in when he dialed into Gridley's scenario. He watched the Net Force operative settle toward the orange roof of the Wong electronics truck on the freeway below. This little gook in his jetpack didn't have a clue who he was dealing with. He was going to get his ass kicked, and Platt was going to love doing it, too. When he was over the truck, and maybe 60 feet up, he opened the copter's window and leaned out, a 25-pound barbell weight in one hand. The steel plate fell, hitting the cab. Nobody got hurt, but it ought to rattle little Jay pretty good.
We're having fun now, ain't we?
Friday, December 31st, 4 p.m., Quantico, Virginia. It was Jay Gridley who was the bearer of bad news.
I think you ought to take a look at this, boss.
Michaels looked at it. He started to read it aloud.
Overlord beasts of America, know you, beasts, that your days are numbered. Know you, oppressors of the disenfranchised people, that the number of the beast is 666. We, the freed sexa, will bring you low, you despoilers of earth.
Michaels looked up from the hard copy.
Freed sex?
It's Danish. It means axis of liberty.
Your wicked ways are manifest and myriad, and we shall reveal your sickness to all. Brother.
Michaels looked at Jay again.
So why didn't you add this one to the pile of other wackaloos claiming responsibility for the leaks?
Next page,
Jay prompted. On the next page was a list of numbers.
Those are the original posting times and dates for all the major leaks we've been running down. We went back and found a posting of the master list for last month's new American Express customer names and numbers. And for all the computer-controlled railroad safety lights and switches on the main commuter line between Washington and Baltimore. A bright hacker could use those to pile half a dozen trains up into big heaps of smoking scrap before somebody figured out what was going on.
Michaels looked at the number. The last one in the sequence read 12-31-10, 11-59-59.
That's tonight, December 31st, 1 second before midnight.
Yes, sir. If these are the guys, they're going to leak something just as the new year arrives.
Any way to trace this?
Sure, we already did. Posted from a payphone in Grand Central Terminal.
Better tell your shift they won't be partying tonight.
Happy New Year, boss.
Yeah, right.
Saturday, January 1st, 2011, 12:03 a.m., Marietta, Georgia. Platt sat in the kitchen of his house, his laptop computer on the wooden table next to the fridge. He took another big old slug of Southern Comfort and Coke over ice and giggled. 4 minutes it had taken the NetForce pukes to snag his posting. Platt was on the wireless modem, had beamed a signal to a rebroadcaster, and then into a little throwaway StoopCom he'd set up in a rented room in San Diego, California. Probably they'd have a team of feds kicking in the room's door in an hour or two, but that was okay. It had given something to do, but finding the computer in San Diego wasn't going to do them no good, no good at all. They couldn't get anything off it that was going to point them at him. The info in the squirt wasn't much. A list of all the patients treated for sexually transmitted diseases reported to the Atlanta CDC MedNet for the last 6 months. It was something to rattle NetForce's cage, to show that the little manifesto Hughes had cooked up was legit. A throwaway, that was all.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We having fun now, ain't we, boys?
Saturday, January 1st, 2011, 1 a.m., Washington, D.C. Hughes sat in bed, reading a recent biography of the Norwegian Vidkun Quisling. Quisling, a career army officer whose name later came to be synonymous with traitor, had in the late 1930s formed in his country a socialist party, the Nasjonal Samling. The biographer was convinced that Quisling's policies had cost Germany the war. Had he not tried so hard to Nazify the country, the writer was convinced there would not have developed much of a Norwegian resistance movement. The resistance movement was never more than a small thorn in the Nazis' side, but it did cause a fair amount of industrial sabotage. Hughes thought this Quisling cost the war theory was something of a stretch, but the writer nonetheless echoed a valid point from all the vaults of history. For want of a nail, a war could be lost. One man, in the right place, at the right time, could alter the course of the entire world. Hughes had always been fond of the story about the French physician Joseph Ignace Guillotin, who helped pass a law requiring legal execution be performed by a machine that would not miss, to be more humane to the condemned, rich and poor alike. What a wonderful legacy for one's relatives. A family name with which to inspire gasps and revulsion. How lovely that must have been. But men like Quisling and Guillotin had been small of vision and not gifted with Hughes's intelligence. In a few days, he would be going to Guinea-Bissau to sit with the head of that small country's government, to strike a deal that would someday be viewed by history as one of the most daring and clever schemes of all time. If history was written by the victors, then surely he would write his own. He did not for a moment doubt it. Saturday, January 1st, 2011, 7 a.m., Washington, D.C. In her kitchen, waiting for the coffee maker to finish brewing, Tony held the sheathed Chris in both hands. Maybe it did have enough magic to help her with Alex. She had been sleeping with it in its wooden sheath on her nightstand, blade carefully pointed away from her head. She was willing to take any help she could get. Tony grinned as the coffee maker chose that instant to gurgle and belch the last of the coffee into the pot, a kind of brewed raspberry noise, almost as if making fun of her. Saturday, January 1st, 2011, 7 a.m., Oro, California. Joanna Winthrop stood in the warm spring sunshine, waiting for the train to arrive. She wore a long, yellow, patterned dress, a bonnet, and held a small, tube-shaped brown leather travel satchel. The year was 1916. She was at the Oro Station in Northern California. She could use some help to find the hacker who had used her computer station. The guy had left a trail, but it was faint and rigged with booby traps all along the way. She was beginning to get really pissed off. When she found this guy and turned him over to the Phoebes, she was hoping to get at least one clean kick at his testicles before they hauled him away. Having your supposedly secure computer station used for sabotage was at the very least embarrassing. It was one thing to be thought beautiful when it got in your way.
It was another thing entirely to be thought inept at what you did for a living.
The incoming train's whistle blew twice, steam-powered hoots that echoed into the station. There were only a few passengers waiting in her scenario, none of them paying any attention to her. She liked this time. It allowed her to wear clothes that could utterly conceal her shape and most of her features. The locomotive arrived, pulling a passenger train of some 16 cars, blasting clouds of steam, its great wheels squealing and squeaking to a halt at the platform. Well, it didn't matter how many traps this Bodo left in his wake. She was going to track him down.
Monday, January 3rd, 8:02 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. Alex Michaels leaned back in his chair and wished he was somewhere else. Just about any place would do, instead of sitting here listening to one of Senator White's staffers drone on at him over the phone.
"So I can pencil you in for the committee meeting?"
Michaels thought about it for a second. What if he said no? That would be fun. They'd have to subpoena him.
"I'd be happy to talk to the Senator's committee."
So, at worst, he'd be on the hot seat for a day or two, assuming nobody else was slotted. After he hung up, Michaels leaned forward in his chair, feeling tired. He'd like nothing better than to take the day off, go for a nice long ride on his bike, to enjoy the cold, crisp morning while working up a little sweat. He grinned at himself. There was a pile of work on his desk that he couldn't get done if he worked 24-hour days for a month.
"Well, you knew the job was dangerous when you took it, right?"
"Right." Monday, January 3rd, 11:15 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. John Howard sat on Doc Kyle's couch in the base clinic, watching the older man flip through the hard copy printout.
"I don't know what to tell you, John. There's nothing growing in any dark corners that shouldn't be there."
"So why am I so tired all the time?"
Kyle grinned.
"Well, now, none of us is getting any younger. A man your age needs to realize he's not going to be able to run basic with the recruits forever."
"You're saying I should slow down?"
"Not should. You will slow down. That's the nature of the beast."
Howard stared at him. It wasn't as if the doc was giving him a death sentence.
"All right. Thanks, Doc."
"Don't take it so hard, kid. You might have a couple more good years left. You want me to write you a prescription for some prunes and geritol?"
Monday, January 3rd, 11:15 a.m., Washington, D.C. Tyrone's life was over. He stood inside Cardio Sports, between the wrist heart monitor display and a display case of stopwatches, staring through the front window into the mall. From where he stood, he could easily see Bella, where she sat at one of the tables. Where Belladonna Wright sat with Jefferson Benson, facing him across the little round white table, holding his hands with her hands, smiling at him.
Oh, God.
Tyrone was on afternoon shift at school like she was, and so he'd asked her if she was going to the mall. They could meet, grab lunch, head for classes. No, she'd said, not today. She had to run some errands, she'd said, so she wasn't going to the mall. She'd see him later at school. Fine, that was no prah. And yet, there she was, sitting there with Benson, holding his fucking hands, smiling at him. She'd lied to him. As he watched, Bella stood, and so did Benson. They moved around the table, closer to each other. Benson bent over. The worst thing he could imagine happened. Benson kissed her. No, there was something even worse than that. She kissed Benson back. Finally, they finished. Benson turned and went one way, Bella the other. What should he do? Should he go out and confront her? See what she said? Oh, man, he wanted to die. Right here, right now. Just go up in a blast of fire and smoke and be dead and gone. And not to know this. Not to have to think about it. Not to have to deal with it. What was he going to do? How could he live with this? At that moment, he couldn't see any way. No way at all.
Monday, January 3rd, 12:10 p.m., Quantico, Virginia. Julio Fernandez stood in the cold at the start of the obstacle course next to the chinning station. He spent 5 minutes warming up, rolling his shoulders and stretching his neck. If he didn't do that, he would probably strain his traps,
and walking around with a sore neck for the next week didn't appeal to him, especially given his already gimpy status. He curled his hips up, pointed his legs. He could even feel that in his wounded leg, then chinned himself. One. He repeated the move, then did it again, getting into the rhythm. Two. Three. Four. Doing it in an L-sit made it harder, but that was the point. The idea was to make the muscles work. Five. Six. Seven. Eight. He let himself down, lowered his legs, released the bar. He was warmed up pretty good now. He caught the bar in an underhand pull-up grip. This time, spaced about shoulder width. That was the only difference between chins and pull-ups, whether your palms faced away or toward you. One. Two. Three. Four. The biceps started to burn first, but the forearms were right there, too. Five. Six. Seven. Eight. It was getting tough now. Nine.
Come on, Julio. You can make it. 10.
He dropped, hung on to the bar for a second, then let go.
I didn't think you were going to make that last one.
He turned. Joanna Winthrop. He grinned.
Me neither.
She wore running shoes and sweats, dark blue pants, and a matching hooded shirt with the NetForce logo on the front.
So, what brings you out here? Too much time at the desk. Every so often I have to get away and clear my head. How's the leg?
You want the macho answer or the truth?
Oh, both, please.
Well, the macho answer is, no problem.
And the truth?
That sucker is sore.
They smiled at each other.
So you're going to do the course?
That was the idea. How about I hobble along and watch? Yeah, I can live with that.
Monday, January 3rd, 12:15 p.m., Quantico, Virginia. Alex was running a little late, and Tony was already dressed and warmed up, practicing Sempak and Deepak postures. She bowed him in and set him to practicing his juru. He only had the first one, but it was obvious he'd been practicing away from class. Another month or two and he'd be ready to start the second. After about 15 minutes, she called a stop. She walked to where her jacket was folded and pulled the kris in its sheath from under the cloth. He raised his eyebrows.
Is this Indonesian?
Yes, my guru presented it to me when I went home for Christmas.
She handed it to him.
The blade is made by welding and hammering various kinds of iron or steel together, then forging them into one piece. Many of the traditional kris are designed to be lucky, in war or love or business.
Which is this one?
She shrugged.
I'm not sure. The magic apparently changes a little with each new owner.
Lucky in love, she hoped. She took the kris, went back to her jacket, and rewrapped the weapon. Back in front of Alex, she said,
Okay, let's work a little on applications from the juru. See, you are bigger and stronger than I am, and if you punch really hard, I might not be able to deflect it using pure muscle. But if I brace my block, thus, and my hips are corked properly, I have a mechanical advantage. Remember, this stuff was created with the idea that if you needed it, your attacker was going to be bigger, stronger, faster, probably armed, and there might be four or five of him.
He smiled. Got it.
You will, you will. Practice makes perfect. Now, punch.
He stepped in, threw a right, and braced with his left hand. She blocked it and demonstrated the counter.
Good. Again. This was going well.
Maybe the kris was lucky in love. Wouldn't that be nice? Tuesday, January 11th, 9:50 a.m., Bombay, India. Jay Gridley walked into the small storefront tobacco shop to the jingle of a spring-mounted warning bell on the doorframe. The time was late 1890s, and the British Raj was still in full sway. Bombay was, of course, Indian, but the English flag draped heavily over the city, as it did the entire country. A month-old copy of the London Times lay upon the counter, next to a large glass jar full of cheap cigars, and a small wooden box of strike-anywhere matches, and a metal tray of cedar lighting sticks. Not what he was looking for. Ah, there it was, the Delhi Ledger. He thumbed through the cheap newsprint and smudged the ink, getting it on his fingers. Well, at least that was a nice touch. The article was ostensibly about Danes come to visit India, but there in the fluffy travel piece was the name he wanted, the Freed Sexer. Once upon a time, Jay would have thought it was odd to find a bit of information about Denmark in an Indian infonet, but not anymore. Information was like dust. It blew around in the wind and wound up in places you'd never think it would. He took the paper to the front, paid for it, and went out into the Indian afternoon. Tuesday, January 11th, 10:15 a.m., Blacktown, New South Wales, Australia. Jay had switched from his tropical linens into an Abercrombie & Fitch khaki outfit, shorts and a short-sleeved shirt. His next stop was a small library in Blacktown, just north and west of Sydney.
"Can I help you, sir?"
"Yes, ma'am, I'm looking for this periodical."
He put a slip of paper onto the woman's desk.
"Oh, right, in the magazine section."
"Thank you, ma'am."
Jay smiled. This was perhaps a little more time-consuming than a non-VR search, but if he couldn't have fun, why bother? Tuesday, January 11th, 10:40 a.m., Johannesburg, South Africa. In a police station in Boksburg, a man arrested for stealing a car had been searched. There had been nothing in the arrestee's wallet save a business card, upon the back of which was the handwritten word Friedsexe. Next to the word was an old-style internet provider ID number. Jay collected the card. He grinned. These Balrogs didn't have a prayer. Tuesday, January 11th, 10:50 a.m., Kobe, Japan. At a beef ranch in Kobe, somebody had broken in and stolen, of all things, a case of beer. Investigating policemen had no clues save one. Scrawled on the wall was the word Friedsexe. Jay made note of that. He was gathering his ducks. When he had enough of them, he would put them into a row. And then...
"Well, we'll just see, won't we? I got your fried sex right here, pal."
Tuesday, January 11th, 11:15 a.m., Miami Beach, Florida. Platt strolled along one of the touristy streets near the canal, enjoying the 70-degree weather. Life was sure grand when you could just pick up and go to where you could walk around in a T-shirt and shorts in the middle of the winter. Platt grinned. He was just stalling so he wouldn't have to go back to work. He sighed. Might as well get to it. He didn't have any illusions about how good he was on the net. He was better than some, but not as sharp as the real experts. In VR, some of the NetForce players would dance circles around him in a head-to-head match. Thing was, tricky and pretty sharp. Beat real sharp every time. And the NetForce pukes were fooling themselves, so that helped a bunch. The NetForce guys were looking for terrorists, because that's what they were most afraid of. So, zap, Platt and Hughes gave them some terrorists. This whole bullshit Danish thing was Hughes's idea, but it was pretty smart. Platt had started planting stuff about the fried socks thing 5 or 6 months ago, so some of the clues were absolute boilerplate when it came to real time. Some of the clues were yet to be put into place, but when they got there, they'd be backdated to seem as if they'd been there for months or years. By the time the NetForce pukes got to those, they wouldn't bother to check, or if they did, they'd do a half-assed job, since that's what they wanted to believe.
"If it looks like a rabbit, smells like a rabbit, and hops like a rabbit, well, hell, it is a rabbit, ain't it?"
When the hounds caught the quarry's scent, when they knew for sure they were on the right track, then he could let them see the rabbit. When it took off running, they'd follow it. They'd never catch it, because it wasn't real. It was a phantom, a spook, a ghost.
And boy, it was going to be fun to watch them chase that sucker.
But of course, the thing he had to do was make sure the hounds still wanted to chase the critter. So this afternoon, he was going to give him a new reason.
A real good reason this time.
Wednesday, January 12th, 6:15 p.m., Washington, D.C. Tyrone Howard pretty much wanted to die. He lay on his bed, staring through the ceiling, unable to move for the weight of what Bella had dropped on him. He had replayed the conversation 100 times in his head.
"So, meet anybody interesting at the mall lately?"
Give her credit, she wasn't stupid, and she didn't pretend she didn't know what he was talking about.
"Maybe I did. What business is it of yours?"
Wham, another punch to the gut.
"Jesus, Bella, I thought we were... you and I mean, we were... what, married? Well, attenzione, Tyrione, we are not. I like you. You're sharp. But I have other friends, you copy? I see them when and where I want. You pra that?"
And then she turned and left. His world went gray. He couldn't hear the students around him, couldn't see anything, couldn't feel anything, except a twist in his stomach.
"Son, you okay?"
Tyrone looked at the doorway. His father stood there.
"Bella and I broke up."
His father came into the room.
"Not your idea, I take it."
"No, not my idea."
"You want to talk about it?"
"No, not really."
But then, as they had with Bella, the words somehow just came tumbling out. John Howard listened to his son, felt his anguish and pain, but there was nothing he could say that was going to heal this wound. A broken heart accepted no medicine except time. That the first case of puppy love squashed would someday be nothing more than a small scar in the grand cosmic scheme of things was not what Tyrone wanted to hear. Still, it was all he had to offer. Howard sighed.
"When I was 16, I was in love. A girl of my school, Lisbeth Toland, same class. We were tight, went everywhere together."
Tyrone stared at him.
"It's kind of hard for you to imagine me with anybody except Mom, isn't it?"
Tyrone nodded.
"Then I got a call from my best friend, Rusty Stevens. He'd been at a bar one night and seen Lisbeth there with somebody he didn't know, partying pretty good."
"That's terrible,"
Tyrone said.
The summer went on. Rusty called again. He'd seen Lisbeth out again, dancing, drinking, different guy, different place. He took it upon himself to follow them when they left. They drove up to Lover's Point, parked in the guy's car, fogged up the windows in the middle of July. So I thanked Rusty and said I'd take care of it. On a Friday night late, I caught a cab to Lisbeth's house. When I got there, I saw Rusty's beat-up old Chevrolet parked out front. Then I looked in and saw Rusty and Lisbeth wrapped around each other in the front seat, both of them half-undressed.
What happened?
I stood there for what felt like a couple million years, watching them kiss and fondle each other. Didn't seem real, like it was a bad dream. I reached out and tapped on the driver's side window. They both jumped a couple feet. Then I left.
Jesus, Dad.
Yep. Lost my girl and my best friend at the same time. I could have punched Rusty's teeth in. But I figured people who do crap like this will get there someday. I didn't want to have anything else to do with them, even to the point of not bloodying my knuckles on Rusty's lying face. There was silence.
Finally, Tyrone said,
"So what happened to them, Rusty and Lisbeth?"
Howard grinned. "They got married right after graduation. He's now a medical doctor. She's an English professor. They have 3 kids, and according to my relatives back home who keep me up to date about such things, they have a wonderful marriage."
He got a small smile back from his son.
"You going to eat supper?"
"I don't think so. I'm really not hungry."
"Okay. I'll cover it with Mom."
"Thanks, Dad. And, Dad, thanks for telling me this story."
"You're welcome, son."
Wednesday, January 12th, 7 p.m., Washington, D.C. The garage sure felt empty. Michael stood in the doorway, looking at the larger of his 2 big metal tool caddies. His most recent project car, the Plymouth Prowler, was gone, sold within a couple of days after he'd gotten it running right. He smiled and walked back into the house. Might as well see what he had for supper. In the kitchen, he dug around in the freezer and came up with a choice of garden burgers or teriyaki chicken sandwiches. He shrugged. The garden burger was going to get freezer burned if he didn't eat it pretty soon, but to hell with it. He wanted the chicken. As he reached for it, the phone rang.
"Hello."
Yeah, hello. I'm looking for Alex Michaels, the guy who does car stuff."
"You found him."
"Oh, hey. My name is Greg Skates. I got your name from Todd Jackson."
Todd Jackson was the man who had bought the Prowler.
"I've got a car Todd thinks you might be interested in."
"What kind of car?"
"It's a Mazda MX-5, a 1995.
Michael's eyebrows went up. MX-5 was better known in the U.S. as the Miata, a little drop-top two-seater, a lot smaller than the Prowler.
"I have to be honest with you, Mr. Michaels. I don't know a lot about it. It belonged to my father, who passed away in November."
"What kind of shape is it in?"
"I can't really say. Dad pulled the tires off and put it up on jacks in his garage. As far as I know, it's been sitting like that for about 15 years.
Michaels felt a surge of interest. You heard about these things. Low or no-mileage cars stored in somebody's barn for future sale.
So what do you figure the car is worth, Mr. Skates?
Greg, please. I don't know, but Todd says if you're interested, you'll offer me a fair price.
I'm interested, Greg. But I'm not going to be able to see the car until Saturday. Can you sit on it that long?
No problem.
Michaels nodded at the unseen speaker.
Good.
He got directions and a time, then hung up. Time for the teriyaki. Thursday, January 13th, 9 a.m. Bissau, Guinea-Bissau. Hughes rode in a bulletproof Cadillac limo from his hotel toward the new presidential palace, and the ride was not particularly impressive. Even though the former president, João Bernardo Vieira, and his African party for the independence of Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde had dragged the locals kicking and screaming into the modern era, it was still a third-world country. There were no railroads, only a couple of thousand miles of badly paved roads, one airport big enough for international flights to land at, and it was cheaper to use local pesos for toilet paper than it was to buy toilet paper. At least it was the dry season. During the monsoons, you didn't walk, you waited. Hughes was on his way to meet President Fernandez Domingos, a not particularly bright man who had somehow lucked into the job. If things went as planned, Hughes would make Domingos richer than he had ever dreamed of being, and able to indulge his tastes in more pleasant circumstances than the dirty streets of Guinea.
"The compound is just ahead, sir,"
the driver said. He was large, white, and had a clipped post-English accent. On the seat next to him lay a submachine gun, and Hughes knew that under his chauffeur's coat the driver also carried a large-caliber pistol. The limo arrived in front of a big electrically operated metal gate in a pink stone wall. A pair of guards with assault rifles outside the gate drifted over and bent to look inside the limo. The Brit nodded at them, and it was obvious they knew him, but he offered his ID anyway. The driveway was circuitous, and wound around several sharp-angled turns bounded by ponds or dirt mounds covered with grass. Eventually, the limo arrived at the entrance to the main building. Standing in front of a set of tall, carved wooden doors was President Fernandez Domingos. Hughes alighted from the limo as the driver held the door.
"Ah, Thomas, how good to see you again.
Mr. President, I am honored." Domingos waved that away.
"No, no, none of that. We are friends. Please come into my humble home. And I would like you to meet Miss Monique Lewis, who has just recently returned from Paris."
Hughes eyed the blonde, who smiled lazily at him, a hint of come-hither in her expression.
"Bonjour," she said. "So nice to make your acquaintance."
Unless he was terribly mistaken, the good president had apparently provided him with a companion. This, Hughes decided, should be interesting. Friday, January 14th, 6 a.m., New York City, New York. At Max, one of the last old-style hardcore gyms in Manhattan, Platt grunted through a set of heavy squats. He was in the safety rack, so the weight wasn't going to fall and crush his ass, but that didn't help his thighs. They burned like he was standing hip-deep in molten lava. Up he came, vibrating, shaking, quivering, fire flowing through his veins and arteries, burning his muscles hot right to the bone. Man! Three more! And he was able, barely, finally, to rack the weight. Around him, the clang of steel echoed as men grunted and strained against the big plates. There were a couple of women here, bodybuilders on the juice, so they looked like men. He liked to see a woman in shape, but not a male shape caused by mojo steroids that did everything but grow a dick on her. Well, enough of this. Time to shower and head for the place in Queens where he had his throwaway computer set up. Friday, January 14th, 8 a.m. Ambarsik, Siberia. Jay Gridley leaned into the fierce wind coming off the East Siberian Sea, a wind so strong and cold that it would blast an unprotected man to death in a matter of seconds. It was an unlikely place to be hunting for clues to a Danish terrorist organization, but there was a blowhole in the ice up ahead where seals came up to breathe, and one of those seals was the packet of information he wanted to find. A klaxon began screaming at him, loud and insistent. What the hell was that? Jay did the mental shift and realized that the klaxon was his real-time override, back at his workstation. A fire in the building, a major system failure. The pizza delivery truck had a flat.
Better check this out quick. Jay logged himself out of VR. Friday, January 14th, 8:05 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. Tony was in the middle of a stack of electronic correspondence when her workstation crashed. Just what she needed, a computer failure. The screen relit, and in its place was a picture of a man's hand. She heard her secretary laugh. "What?" Tony yelled.
"My computer is giving me the finger."
Tony had a sudden sinking feeling that this image was not confined to just two stations. It didn't take long for her to learn she was right. Tony met Jay Gridley as they both headed for the conference room. Joanna Winthrop beat them there by half a second. Alex was already there.
"Freed Sexa. They got in through a subsystem in FBI personnel. In theory, it's not supposed to be cross-linked with secure systems without gate passwords, but supervisors looking for new employees occasionally leave it open. We're running full diagnostics," Jay added, "but I can guarantee they won't find any more infection."
Alex shook his head.
"You're wrong, Jay. This is a major hit."
Tony said, "NetForce is supposed to be the guardian for the nation's computer systems. If this group can get into our supposedly secure setup, how does that make us look?"
"Tony, see what you can do for damage control,"
Alex said to her. To Jay and Joanna, he said,
"Try and backwalk this. See if you can get us any leads. I have a feeling this is going to get real ugly on us if we don't short-circuit it pretty quick. Go!"
After Jay and Joanna were gone, Tony sat alone with Alex.
"You okay?"
she asked. "I'm fine. It's just all this."
He waved one hand to encompass NetForce and all its problems. But he wasn't all right. She could see that. She hadn't asked about his visit with his daughter and ex-wife, and Tony suspected that maybe the visit hadn't gone well. But it wasn't her place to ask.
"Okay, you know where to find me."
She stood, started to leave.
"Tony."
"Hmm?"
"I'm going to look at a new car tomorrow. I was, wondering, that is, would you like to go along and help me check it out?"
"Oh, baby, he's asking you out. Slow. Go slow. Don't scare him off."
She managed her breath.
"Yeah, I'd like that."
"I want to get an early start, so why don't I pick you up about 7?
7 would be good."
For a long moment, a couple of millennia, anyhow, she stood there, staring at him, feeling so bubbly she wanted to jump up and down and scream. Finally, she pulled herself away.
"Okay," she said, "I'll go work on the hack."
Once she was out of the conference room, her back to Alex, she could not stop the grin.
"Yes, yes!"
When he'd been 13, Alex Michaels had ridden the Tyler, Texas Tornado, at the time the world's largest roller coaster. He felt like that now, as if he'd just gone over the first drop.
"Jesus H. Christ, what did you just do? Did you just ask Tony Fiorella, your assistant, out on a date?"
He knew this was not a smart thing to be doing. Tony worked for him, and yeah, he'd gotten vibes from her that she didn't exactly find him hideous or anything, but this was dangerous territory. He didn't have to risk losing Tony as a friend and co-worker by pushing it into romance. He could keep his hands to himself, his pants zipped, and keep it platonic.
"Right. Was that why you asked her to take a little drive down to Fredericksburg, to be Mr. Platonic?"
"Shut up," he told himself. "Nothing has happened. Nothing is going to happen.
We're friends, that's all."
His inner voice laughed at him all the way back to his office. Friday, January 14th, 8:20 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. When Tony Fiorella walked past her, Joanna Winthrop looked at the woman and was sure her suspicions were dead on target. Miss Tony had the hots for their boss. The truth was, Winthrop had entertained a couple of fantasies in that direction herself. Well, at least before she'd started finding reasons to drop by and see Julio Fernandez. She grinned to herself. Winthrop was finding that lately she had developed a real hankering for Hispanic food. Friday, January 14th, 5:45 a.m., High Desert, Eastern Oregon. It was still dark outside of the one-man funnel tent. Dark and cold, too, but at least the snow had started falling again. John Howard wasn't exactly toasty in his sleeping bag, but considering this was his winter survival weekend, he was warm enough, except he had to go pee. Howard slid out of the sleeping bag, already dressed in long underwear, pants, socks, and a heavy wool shirt. He pulled his boots on. Damn, they were chilly. Grabbed a jacket and hat and scooted out of the tent. He ambled a few yards off along the path he'd packed down before he'd turned in the night before and wrote his name in a snowbank, piled up against what looked like a frozen and pretty sad about it creosote bush. Back inside, he started a snowmelt pot of water heating. He had a little hike ahead of him today, just 10 miles, but on snowshoes and with a backpack, it would work him some. He had a GPS if he got lost, though he tried to locate his next campsite the old-fashioned way, with a compass and landmarks. At 6 a.m., he pulled his Virgil and keyed his morning check-in code. If something happened and he couldn't call out, NetForce could find him via the little device, which had a homer with a dedicated battery in it. The water started to boil, and Howard dug in his pack for the freeze-dried coffee crystals. What he was about to drink wasn't in the same class as freshly roasted and freshly ground premium beans strained through a gold filter and served in fine china by a well-practiced and attentive waiter. But the first cup of coffee on a survival campout was always better than the best restaurant stuff. Always. Friday, January 14th, 11 p.m. Bissau, Guinea-Bissau. Hughes rolled over in the king-sized orthopedic bed and watched as Monique waded through the ankle-deep white carpet toward the bathroom. After 3 sessions with her, last night, a quickie at noon, and tonight, he was completely spent, tired, and more relaxed than he'd been in years. This was one of the perks of wealth, a well-practiced mistress, and he toyed with the idea of hiring Monique full-time. He could afford her now, and soon would be able to afford thousands like her. He glanced at his watch, just after 11 o'clock. What would that make it in D.C.? It didn't matter. Platt was back there, merrily adding gasoline to various fires, setting up the project's end stage. Negotiations had gone well with Domingos, even better than he'd expected. Another $30 million had been thrown into the pot, bringing the payout to the president to an even $100 million U.S. Or, if he preferred, he could have it in French francs, Japanese yen, or British pounds. Or dinars, rupiahs, rubles, or Guinea-Bissau's own pesos. Dollars would be fine, the president had allowed. Hughes grinned again as the bathroom door swung open, and Monique walked through the thick carpet toward him. The view was even better from the front, he decided. Even the breast implants had been hung by an expert medico, for they looked, and felt, quite real. Spent as he thought he was, he felt a bit of stirring in his groin.
Ah, you are awake, I see.
Not all of me.
Oh, but I am certain I can remedy that. Oui?
He chuckled. If anybody could raise his hopes, certainly Monique could. Let's see, shall we?
Saturday, January 15th, 7:25 a.m., Henry G. Shirley Memorial Highway, near Indian Springs, Virginia.
You want to stop for coffee or something?
Alex asked.
No, I'm fine, Tony said. I had my 2 cups already.
He smiled at her, a little awkwardly, she thought.
Yeah, me too.
Tony had the impression that he wished he hadn't done this. Invited her to go along with him to look at the Miata.
You talked to Jay this morning? She said.
I checked his Vox around 6, heard his update.
Tony had also checked the coded message, but to keep the conversation going, she pretended she hadn't.
Anything new?
No, I feel a little guilty about taking the day off.
Nothing you could do at the office.
I know, but even so...
She nodded. She was in a car with Alex going somewhere other than on NetForce business. Maybe there was justice. Or maybe Guru's Chris had some magic left in its black and convoluted steel. She grinned.
Something funny?
No, just a pleasant thought.
Saturday, January 15th, 7:45 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. Joanna wasn't scheduled to work this morning, but she was on her way into HQ anyway. She still hadn't run down the SOB who had used her station to post that fruitcake militia thing, though she had figured out it was done by remote and not in person.
This latest incursion with the finger image pissed her off even more, even though it hadn't come through her in particular. It was a slap in the face, a direct challenge to NetForce, and she took it personally. She was going into the net for some serious web-walking to find these creeps, or at least that was her intention. As she was heading in, she saw Julio Fernandez in his sweats, limping back from the direction of the obstacle course.
"I'm going to be doing some work on the web. You want to come along, sit in? I can show you some of the more interesting aspects of VR." "I'd like that. I still ought to hit the showers first. I'm a little ripe."
She sniffed.
"I think I can stand being in the same room with you. Come on."
"Yes, ma'am." Saturday, January 15th, 9 a.m., Washington, D.C. The thing was, Tyrone realized, you could only lie in bed staring at the ceiling so long before it got boring. Real boring. In a flash of clarity, Tyrone appreciated how boring he must have been to be around lately. It was Bella this, or Bella that, or Bella the other, and his friends, such as they were, must have elected him king of the dull and stupids on the first ballot. He grinned at himself. Pretty sorry when the only two things in your life were computers and a lying girlfriend, and you didn't even have her anymore. No, no, he needed to do something. But what to do on a chilly, sunny day? "And now for local events," the vox from the newscom droned. "The 6th annual Boomerang Tournament begins in Lonsdale Park at 8 a.m. Saturday and runs through Sunday at 5 p.m. What was a boomerang tourney? Those Aborigine things, the sticks? He grinned. All right, yeah, he could do that. He'd never even seen a boomerang except in VR, and then only as a background scenario. Why not? A short guy, built like a brick, was in the middle of the soccer field. He reared back with a day-glow orange boomerang in his right hand, concave side forward, one end up, and threw the thing so hard his hand went forward and touched the ground. The guy never moved his feet. He didn't have to. It came right back to him.
I gotta have one of these.
Tyrone had been watching for about an hour. There was a break in the action, and he headed for the little tables that had been set up for sales.
Knew it this might,
the man behind the table said. He had an accent so thick he could lean against it. Australian.
Yeah, but I want to learn.
Right. How much you looking to spend, then?
Tyrone pulled his credit card out of his pocket and called up his balance. He told the seller the amount.
Hey, for that, you can get just about anything on the table. Though you might want to start with a sturdy model until you get the hang of it.
Tyrone examined the boomerang. It was wood, plywood. And while it was flat on the bottom, except for a scalloped outer edge under the paint, the top edges were angled.
This one'll run to about $20 U.S.
Tyrone realized he hadn't thought about Bella, but once since he'd gotten here, and then only briefly.
Comes with a membership in the International Boomerang Association. We got a great website.
Tyrone grinned.
I'll take it.
Saturday, January 15th, 11:55 a.m., Eastern Oregon. Howard found a sunny spot to break for lunch. It was warming up under the clear skies, though it was still not what you'd call warm, probably a degree or two above freezing. He dumped a couple of handfuls of snow into his cookpot, then began melting the snow to reconstitute some freeze-dried chicken and vegetables, kind of like a pot pie without the crust. He glanced up and saw a blob of melting snow slip from a high branch and fall, coming right at him. The big chunk missed him by a good 2 feet, but he stumbled and put out one hand to catch himself on the tree. He spun around the tree and away, pleased with himself at avoiding most of the icy bath. He didn't stay pleased. The tree that lost its snow load popped upright like a bent spring, released. It hit the tree next to it, hard. The second tree snapped in half 10 feet off the ground. He barely had time to get his arms up over his head before it fell on him. Saturday, January 15th, 2:30 p.m., Fredericksburg, Virginia. From under the Miata's hood, Alex said,
"Okay, try it again."
She did. After a second, the engine caught and began a throaty rumble.
"Yes!"
Tony and Alex said at the same time. Greg Skates, the car's former owner, had come and gone. Alex had made an offer straight away and transferred the agreed sum from his credit card to Greg's account. He had every intention of driving the thing home.
"So, let's take her out for a little spin."
Tony started to get out of the car.
"No, go ahead. You drive. You can use a manual shift, can't you?"
"Sure."
"All right, then.
Let's see how she rides.
Tony eased the clutch out, and the Miata scooted forward. It was a responsive beast, the steering tight, and cornering was a delight. She took a 30-mile-per-hour curve at 50, no problem.
Push it up to 70.
Traffic was light, so Tony goosed it a little. A few miles up the highway, she turned into a supermarket parking lot. Your turn. You've been itching to drive since we hit the street. Behind the wheel, he checked his outside mirrors.
Oh, that one's a little off.
Stretched out across her, one hand out of the car, he glanced up at her face from a few inches away. She could smell him, his sweat, his aftershave, his mouth close enough to kiss. Without thinking any more, she did just that. Alex brought his hand away from the mirror, put it behind her head, and held her there. He worked his lips, opened his mouth, and found her tongue with his. There must be a God, Tony thought. Saturday, January 15th, 12:15 p.m., Eastern Oregon. No two ways about it. Howard was trapped. The tree's bole had come to rest on the back of his left calf and had pinned him to the ground, face down. He had tried to lift the trunk, then to shove it off using his free leg, but that was not going to happen. This was not a good situation. He was in the middle of nowhere, staked to the snowy ground like a bug to a display board, his electronics out of reach. He was dressed for the weather, but come sundown, it was going to get very cold. No, all in all, he would say, this was definitely not good.
Okay, John, let's take stock here. What have you got in the way of good news?
Well, he had his sheath knife. He knew if he could twist himself around long enough, he could eventually cut through the wood. It might take a long time, but it wasn't as if he was going anywhere. Well, okay, he could always cut his leg off from the knee down, right? Hold on a second. There was another option. The LAIC maneuver. LAIC. Look at it crooked. If he couldn't solve a problem going in through the front door, what about the back door? Howard looked at his leg and grinned. All he had to do was dig a hole under his shin, come in from the side, hollow enough out so the leg would drop, and then all he'd have to do would be to pull it out, right? Look at it crooked. The topsoil was mostly sand, and the rocky clay under it was frozen, but it took less than an hour to excavate himself. The ankle wasn't even sprained. His foot was sore, but not so much he couldn't walk on it, and Howard felt immensely pleased with himself as he ate his delayed lunch.
There was nothing like a victory to give you a sense of control. It might be an illusion, but it sure felt good in the moment. Yes, sir, it did.
Saturday, January 15th, 2:45 p.m., Fredericksburg, Virginia. Somebody honked their car horn and laughed as they drove past, but Alex didn't care. God, Tony felt so good. Her lips were warm, soft. Her hands on his back pulled him closer. Her breasts against his chest. Ah. His Virgil cheeped. Damn.
Commander, Jay Gridley, sorry to bother you, boss, but, well, the shit has just hit the fan.
What?
The fried sex guys just crashed the U.S. internet bank system. I hope you got some money in your pocket, because you ain't going to be cashing your federal check today.
Damage control.
We're throwing water on it, but we're talking mega forest fire, boss.
I'm on my way. Discom.
Michaels looked at Tony.
I'm sorry.
I hope you're talking about the call.
Yeah, I am, but this...
He waved one hand back and forth between them.
This sort of thing brings up all kinds of problems.
She grinned.
You want to sleep with me?
Yes, of course.
I'll quit.
Excuse me?
If you sleep with me, I'll resign.
Tony...
No, I'm serious. If it would be a problem for you as my supervisor, then we can fix that.
Why? I'm not that wonderful.
You underestimate yourself. I'm serious about this.
Saturday, January 15th, 9:45 p.m., Hana, Maui, Hawaii. Winthrop was on the net, in joined VR, showing Julio some of the ins and outs of the web weave. She had allowed him to conjure a program, and what he had come up with was a beach on Maui, near Hana. They were in personal persona, dressed in skimpy swimsuits, walking barefoot on a black sand beach. The water continued to ebb, and Winthrop looked farther out to sea.
Uh-oh.
What?
I just realized what's happening. See there?
Julio squinted into the sunshine. Looks like a big wave.
Yeah, it's a big wave, all right, and it's going to get a lot bigger as it gets closer. It's a tsunami.
A tidal wave?
Something big is happening on the net. I hate to cut the lesson short, but we need to jack out of this scenario and see what RW scans show.
Yes, ma'am. You're the expert.
Saturday, January 15th, 2:45 p.m., Quantico, Virginia. Fernandez came back to himself in the computer room, sitting next to Joanna. She was tapping furiously at the keyboard on the desk. Jay Gridley came running into the room.
Winthrop, you see what the hell is happening?
We need to scramble some programmers, Jay.
Already did it. Boss is on the way in.
You call Fiorella?
She's with him. Isn't that interesting?
Ah, old news. You need to pay more attention to RW around you, Gridley.
Screw you, Winthrop.
In your dreams, monkey fingers.
In my nightmares, you mean.
Hold up, I got something. Jeez, I can't believe the guy is that dumb. Jay?
I've got a lock.
How'd you do that, Winthrop? I found a ghost on my station, from when he broke in here. There wasn't anywhere to go with it. It petered out, but just in case, I set up a scan and match.
Good work. You ready to run him down?
I'd like to kick his ass personally, but much as I hate to say it, you're better at this part than I am, Gridley. Go get him.
When Tony and Alex arrived, there was a lot of commotion in the computer center. Alex moved to where Joanna sat, and as Tony started to head for her office to assess damage reports, Fernandez's smile stopped her.
Something funny I'm missing?
No, ma'am. Nothing funny.
Why the grin? Oh, I was just, you know, musing. About what?
You and the commander.
Oh, God, does it show? We haven't even done anything yet. What about us, Sergeant?
Just lucky how you both get here so quick.
You're a poor liar, Julio.
Yes, ma'am.
She hurried down the hall.
He knew. How?
How could he know? Well, worry about that later. Right now, they had a crisis to weather.
One thing at a time, girl. One thing at a time.
Saturday, January 15th, 3:10 p.m., Marietta, Georgia. Platt was feeling damn good about his latest caper on the net. It was amazing what you could do when you had a bunch of secret codes and passwords, courtesy of somebody who had access to a U.S. senator. He was in the bathroom when he heard the alarm go off. After a second, he realized it was coming from his computer on the kitchen table. He moved fast, tapped in the confirmation code. Maybe it was just a software error, a glitch that tripped the audible. Ah, shit! It wasn't an error. They had traced his signal. Platt shut the computer off. He had to get out of here. Now. How the hell could this have happened?
Worry about it later, Hoss. Right now, you get your ass in gear and lay tread.
Saturday, January 15th, 8:15 p.m. Guinea-Bissau. Hughes smiled at Domingos across the table and raised his wine glass in salute. They sipped their wine, watching the waiters clear away their plates and reset for the next course.
So, everything goes well, does it not?
Hughes glanced at his watch.
Even as we speak, Excellency, my agents are finalizing matters.
Hughes smiled as he sipped the wine. Right about now, his agent Platt would be feeling an unexpected heat. He surely didn't want Platt in custody, but he did want the redneck off balance, a little edgy, and looking to his employer for some reassurance. If a man thinks you're reaching a hand out to help him climb from a pit, he might not notice the knife in your other hand. Saturday, January 15th, 4:30 p.m., Washington, D.C. After he'd bought the boomerang, Tyrone had spent a couple of hours at the park playing with it. By the time his arm was tired and he was ready to go home, he had figured out a lot of stuff about which way the wind was blowing. His phone cheeped. Tyrone pulled it from his belt clip. Hello?
Hey, son. How you doing?
Dad, you okay? You don't usually call during these things.
Actually, I had a little excitement this morning. A tree fell on me.
A tree? Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm fine. How you doing?
Geez, Dad, a tree falls on you and you're worried about me?
It's what fathers do, Ty.
Well, I'm flowing fine. I just got a boomerang.
Great. You can brush me up on how to use it when I get home. I'm out of practice.
Yeah, that would be great.
Saturday, January 15th, 6:30 p.m., Quantico, Virginia. Michaels was in his office, worrying about 12 different things, when one of those things came in.
Alex?
Tony, what's up?
FBI and the Georgia State boys ran down the address outside Marietta.
She put a sheaf of hard copy on his desk, including a photo.
That's him, the son.
Seems to be something of a stretch, doesn't it?
Alex said. From Danish terrorists to a Georgia cracker?
I've been thinking about that. It seems kind of odd that nobody ever heard of this freed sexer before all this started.
What do you mean? Jay has dug up all kinds of references, going back years.
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but just for the sake of argument, let's say these Danish terrorists didn't exist until 6 months ago. Why would they bother to plant information that said they were a lot older?
Michaels nodded.
Good point. Why would they bother?
Came the dawn into his head, a few bright streaks painting the dark sky of his mind.
Maybe there isn't any such group as Freed Sexa. Maybe it's somebody who wants us looking for a terrorist group that doesn't exist.
Well, it's just a theory.
Let's put Freed Sexa on the back burner, check on what systems were hit, and who might benefit from them being damaged or down.
She stood.
I'll go talk to Jay and Joanna.
She started to leave.
Tony...
Yes?
About that thing in the Miata.
I can't forget it, Alex. But I can pretend nothing happened, if that's what you want.
Michaels watched Tony disappear from view. He shook himself and blew out a big sigh. Worry about that later.
His comm beeped.
Yeah.
Your ex-wife is on three.
Michaels laughed. Of course she was.
Take a message, he said.
Saturday, January 15th, 11:45 p.m., Kansas City, Kansas.
There they are,
Winthrop said.
Rats, Jay said. You had to pick rats.
You'd rather have cute little puppies or kittens?
Jay shook his head and raised the 12-gauge pump shotgun to his shoulder. She had a flashlight and a laser sight mounted on her South African street sweeper. The brown rats, the size of cocker spaniels and with mouths full of long yellow teeth, milled around in the dead-end alley, looking around for a means of escape. But the only path out was blocked by Winthrop and Gridley. Winthrop fired first, getting off two shots before Jay pulled the trigger on his weapon. Big rats turned into bloody red clumps of twisting fur as the buckshot tore into them. In reality, the rats were circular subroutines with escape and evasion codings, eating up storage space in the Federal Reserve's KC division. The city had been evacuated, the computer had been taken offline, so that the exterminators could come in and clear out the infestation. Winthrop touched her headset.
We've cleared the alley behind the bank. We're moving into the one next to the Thai restaurant on the south side.
As they walked across the street toward the Thai place, she said,
Oh, by the way... Nice job on running down that Platt guy.
Aw, shucks, ma'am. Twern't nothing. Wrong persona, Gridley. All right, how about no pry, fam?
Better.
Sunday, January 16th, 1:15 a.m., Atlanta, Georgia. Platt knew that Hughes wouldn't like being woken up early, and it must be 6 or 7 in Spookland over there, but he wanted to be sure to catch him when he wasn't busy. He wasn't supposed to be calling Hughes at all, unless it was an emergency, and given as how he had gotten away clean, maybe it wasn't an emergency anymore, but to hell with it, he was going to call anyhow. He used one of the one-time scramblers and a payphone in the lobby of the Stonewall Jackson Memorial Motel on the outskirts of College Park. Hughes had his Virgil rigged up to rascal his call with a military-grade scrambler built into it, so nobody would trace nothing.
Howdy, boss. We got a little situation here you need to know about.
Hold on a second.
Hughes put him on hold, and Platt grinned. Somebody was being sent to the John.
All right, what?
The feds ain't as stupid as they look. They backwalked a signal to my mama's house.
How could that happen?
Don't matter as much how as they did it. I had to hightail it out pretty quick. I'm going to have to do a little ID switching.
How about the other thing?
That went smooth as oil on a baby's butt. Our bank boy from the place in, where was it, Minnesota, Iowa, whatever, should be able to do the deed like he's supposed to.
Right. Later, then.
Platt pushed the disconnect button down.
Hmm.
Hughes hadn't seemed as upset as he'd expected. Truth was, Platt trusted him about as far as he could pitch the man one-handed. You had to pay attention at times like this, Platt had learned. People always look out for their own interests, first, last, and in between.
And Mama Platt didn't raise no fools.
Sunday, January 16th, 1:45 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. Commander Michaels called them into the conference room for a quick meeting. Winthrop, Fiorella, and Gridley.
Federal banking systems are still at risk, but all security programs are being updated and changed, so the old passwords won't get the guy back in again, Michaels said.
He got those, Gridley said. What's to say he won't get the new ones?
The bank programmers are using the new tag system. If somebody breaks in, we'll know where the leak got sprung. Now, what's the situation on this guy Platt? Joanna.
Platt dropped out of high school in his junior year, got into some local trouble. Next time we see him is when he was busted for assault and battery in New Orleans, age 24. He apparently attacked a man on the street for no good reason, beat him senseless. He posted bail and never showed for the trial. In 2006, Platt was arrested on a drunken disorderly charge in Trenton, New Jersey. He walked into a bar and started a fight. Four men wound up in the hospital. And that's it. He has no credit records, no driver's license, no work history. He's never paid Social Security, or filed a tax return, or applied for a passport. At least not under the name Platt. A thug, Fiorella said. Hardly seems like the mastermind behind computer break-ins.
Is there anything that ties his crimes together? Michaels asked.
Gridley said,
The guy's a racist. He beats up on black men. We got an armbreaker-turned-computer wizard who's smart enough to put a big, fat red herring in our way, so he's got us running around looking for Danish terrorists. This doesn't scan.
Michaels nodded. All right, so Platt has help. Thanks, people. You've all done good work.
Michaels got to his feet. The meeting was over. In the hall, Julio leaned against a wall, favoring his bad leg.
Going back into the trenches?
Nope. Boss says go home and get some sleep.
Sounds like a good idea. You know anything I can do to relax, Julio?
Yes, ma'am. I believe I can offer some exercises you might try.
All right. Come on, then. You can show me at my place.
He straightened up, stood to attention, then gave her a snappy, crisp salute.
Yes, ma'am. Anything the lieutenant says.
They headed down the hall. Sunday, January 16th, 8 a.m., St. Louis, Missouri. Platt's clean phone beeped, the little European police siren tone he'd set up that meant the bank guy was calling.
Yep.
It's done.
Any trouble?
No, I got it from more than 500 large government and corporate accounts, no chunk big enough to raise eyebrows.
How much did you get?
There was a second's pause.
$180 million, just as we agreed.
Peterson wasn't a real criminal. He didn't have the right mindset. He didn't know the real problems that came from stealing large money. Because when you tapped a big score, it wasn't the police dogs you had to worry about. It was the wolves.
All right,
Platt said.
Go where I told you to go. I'll be in touch tomorrow.
Platt broke the connection. Poor bank boy. He was hooked and cooked, any way you looked at it. As he made a call to make certain Peterson had been at least partially straight with him, Platt thought about bank boy's unhappy future. A pro would have set up an identity months or even years ahead of time. You needed the cover, see? The cops, if they caught you, they were just going to toss your butt in jail, but as soon as you hit the road, the bounty hunters would be right behind you. The wolves. And the bounty they'd collect if they caught you was everything you had, up to, and probably including, your life. No. What you did with a big score was, you took your money, and you set up some kind of small business. Or you lived the middle-class life of a retiree, drove a car a couple of years old, lived in a nice middle-class house. You didn't send Christmas cards to your ex-wife. You didn't go to your mother's funeral. You cut your ties with your past clean, and you never looked back. Hughes would do whatever he was going to do over in Boogaland with his 140. And Platt? Well, that was simple. Platt was going to buy a hardcore gym in Kona on the big island of Hawaii. The place was well managed, so Platt wouldn't have to do anything, and the climate was perfect. Sure, Hughes had big plans. He was going to be master of the world. But what was the point?
You could only sleep in one bed at a time, only drive one car at a time, only eat so much a day. And now, one more call.
Yes. It's a done deal, Hoss.
He could almost hear Hugh's grin from 10,000 miles away.
Good. Everything else okay?
No problems at all.
Breaking the connection, Platt fired up his portable computer and sent one brief signal, winging its way into the Ethernet. He didn't trust good old Mr. Hughes, so he'd set up a failsafe or two as insurance.
'Cause you never knew when a little insurance just might come in handy.
Sunday, January 16th, 7 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. Naked, Fernandez rolled over in bed and marveled at his good fortune. He reached out, touched her face.
You know, nobody even comes in a close second to last night.
I bet you say that to all the girls.
No, just you, Joe.
Thank you. You can say that all you want, too. And I can't remember ever having a better time with my clothes off, either.
He slid out from under the covers and started for the bathroom.
Julio?
Yeah?
You'll do. Start the shower, please.
Yes, ma'am. On the double.
Sunday, January 16th, 7:40 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. Jay Gridley was still tired, having managed only an hour or so of sleep, but he felt good, the tiredness notwithstanding. Platt was the key to this whole thing, and while he had vanished, he might not be as smart as he thought he was. There are some basic mistakes you want to avoid. You don't piss into the wind. You don't eat at a place called Mom's, and you don't pull your program on Lonesome Jay Gridley. Bad idea. Marietta, Georgia. The inside of the telegraph office smelled of must and pipe tobacco. Jay smiled and tipped his hat at the telegraph operator.
I'm Captain Jay Gridley, detached from General Lee's staff. We are seeking a Yankee spy, a Southerner who goes by the name of Platt. We do believe he might have been sending coded messages by wire.
After a minute of thumbing through the stack of yellow paper, the telegrapher shook his head.
Captain, I'm afraid I cannot find any messages sent or received under the name of Platt.
Jay laid out the general description of Platt, then proffered a pen and ink sketch he withdrew from inside his coat. The telegrapher frowned at the drawing.
I'm sorry to report that I do not recognize this man. However, if you'll wait a moment... Buford, put down that broom and get yourself in here.
A moment later, a tall and gangly boy of 13 or so appeared.
Yes, sir?
Jay repeated the description and showed the boy the drawing.
Why, yes, sir, Captain, sir. I do recall him. I recollect that he called himself Rogers. Sir, Mr. Rogers, he sent a message, and he gave me a nickel for the copy. He took it with him.
Do you remember who Mr. Rogers sent the wiregram to, the name, or the station?
Yes, sir. I remember the station.
Jay grinned.
Ha! Now I gotcha, Platt.
Sunday, January 16th, 8:05 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. Jay thundered into Michael's office, waving a hard copy print and yelling,
Boss, I got him! I got him!
Slow down, Jay. You got who?
Platt. Who he's working for.
Michaels listened with half his attention. There were several items on the list Jay had handed to him. Circled in red was a number, and written in red next to it was a name. Thomas Hughes.
Who is this Hughes you've circled?
He's a chief of staff for a United States senator.
Michaels made the connection. Of course.
White.
Yes, sir. And isn't it funny that our thug computer guy is calling Hughes? What could the two of them possibly have in common, do you suppose?
Sunday, January 16th, 8:55 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. Tony met Alex and Jay in the conference room.
Tony, what have we got?
Having a word with Hughes right now is going to be difficult. He's gone on a trip.
Ethiopia?
How do you know that?
From his staff guy when he called to schedule me for a committee meeting.
What I don't understand is, what would he have to gain from this?
I think I have the answer for that,
Joanna said from the doorway. She waved her flat screen,
While we were all running around, stamping out little fires on the bank incursion yesterday, somebody snuck in and siphoned off almost $200 million.
That lets White out, Alex said. He's probably got more money than that in his personal checking account.
No, it gets better, Joanna said. Seems an anonymous tip to the FBI has just resulted in the arrest of one Jamal S. Peterson, a former bank employee wanted for a similar kind of sting in South Dakota last month.
And he's been picked up?
About 15 minutes ago.
Alex glanced over at Joanna. Stay on it.
Right, boss.
First thing the rest of us have to do is find out where Hughes is. Then we'll worry about how much immunity he thinks he's got. Go, people. Find me a bank thief. Oh, and good work on what we've done so far. You four are the best. Don't let anybody ever tell you different.
Yeah, but who gets the trip to Hawaii?
Jay said. Go, Jay. We aren't done yet. And while you're looking, get me everything you can on Hughes. Let's find out what we're dealing with here.
Sunday, January 16th, 9:15 a.m., Eastern Oregon. John Howard was 5 miles into the morning's trek when his Virgil cheeped at him. Assistant Commander of Net Force Tony Fiorella. Colonel, we've got a situation here, and Alex, Commander Michaels, wants you back at HQ. Find a flat spot, sir, and a copter will be there to pick you up as soon as possible.
This come.
Giving up his survival trip for a real assignment was not in the least bit distressing for him. War games and camping trips were only the maps, not the territory. Sunday, January 16th, 2:15 p.m., Bissau, Guinea-Bissau. A minute, a coded password, and 160 million electronic dollars flew from Bali to Bissau, into the government-owned Banco Primero de Bissau, where it was now as safe from the U.S. authorities' grasp as was the surface of Saturn. In his room, seated cross-legged on the bed, Hughes took a deep breath and let it slowly escape. So easy. Amazing. The room's phone rang.
Yes?
President Domingo sends his regards and wonders if it might be convenient for you to join him for a drink in the Blue Room in perhaps half an hour.
That would be fine.
Sunday, January 16th, 10 a.m., Quantico, Virginia.
Guinea-Bissau, Alex said. Where the hell is that?
West Africa, Tony said. Between Senegal and Guinea.
Okay, so how do we know Hughes is there?
I have a contact at the CIA who checked it out for me.
There came a knock at the door. Joanna stood there.
Good news, I hope.
The federal hounds paid the entry fee, that's a bribe to you and me, to bank officials in Bali, and got into the account where the money was.
Alex blew out a sigh.
Was? I take it that word is a key here?
Correct. The account was emptied less than an hour ago. Went to something called the Banco Primero de Bissau. That's in...
Guinea-Bissau.
I'm impressed, sir. I'd never heard of the place before.
So, our white-collar thief and his stolen millions are in a country with whom we probably don't have an extradition treaty.
Hold up a second, Tony said. He doesn't know, we know, he's a thief, and he's due to return to the country next week. Wouldn't he just come back with the senator?
Alex looked at her and smiled.
You're right. We can wait a few days. That would keep me from having to explain to the director why I invaded a third-world country and kidnapped somebody. Brilliant, Tony.
Tony smiled. Any time she could get that kind of response from him, she was happy. Sunday, January 16th, 8 a.m., Chicago, Illinois. Platt had booked a commercial flight from O'Hare to Heathrow, where he'd switch airlines for the hop to North Africa, before transferring to a local crop duster flight to Ooga Booga. He got some breakfast, hit the magazine racks, went to the John, then found a place to sit and read near where his gate was. He spotted the two feds when they came in. They were looking for somebody, and he didn't think much about it. Maybe the feds didn't know he'd spotted them. That might buy him a couple of minutes. But he couldn't chance trying to leave by the front door. There could already be local cops heading that way. He stood and walked toward the exit that led to the gates. It was the fastest way out of the building. The airline clerk looked at him.
Sir?
That door says no entrance right over there. Some kid just went in and closed the door behind her.
I'll check it out.
It's right over here,
Platt said, smiling. Once she'd punched in the number and opened the door, Platt stepped in behind the woman.
wrapped his arm around her throat, and squeezed her carotids shut. They were unloading a jet two gates over, and Platt hurried in that direction. A guy on one of those motorized conveyor trucks passed him. Platt waved him down.
"What's up?"
Platt smiled, grabbed the guy, then gave him one in the gut, and one upside the head, knocking him senseless. Platt grabbed his earphones and hopped on the conveyor truck. He put it in gear and took off. Ahead was a section of the airport where the express package and cargo service planes were parked. He grinned as the idea hit him.
"Good morning, sir," the manager of the freight place said. "How can I help you?"
Platt smiled.
"Well, sir, I got this big old shipment of farm machinery sitting on a loading dock in London, England, and no way to get it home."
"That's what we're here for, sir."
"The thing is, the original airline I hired, well, they crapped out on me. See, it saves me about $10,000 if I can show I paid the money about 3 weeks ago. Now, I'd like to hire one of your planes to fly over there and pick up my machinery. Nothing illegal here, sir. I got proper papers on everything. But if I don't use my first charter date, I'm going to lose $10,000. Let's just say, you know, for instance, if you had taken this order from me, say, around Christmas time, how much of a problem would that be?"
"Well, sir, if I had taken the order and somehow forgotten to enter it into the computer, I could correct that when I filled out the paperwork and predate it so it matched the actual date I took the order."
Platt smiled, one man of the world to another.
"Well, sir, if you was to do that, I would be mighty grateful."
He put $1,000 bills on the desk and slid them towards the kid. He had his ride, and any feds looking for him wouldn't find it, since it would have been booked 2 weeks earlier and under another name. Once he got to England, getting a flight to Africa would be easy. Then he and Mr. Thomas Hughes would have some words.
Yes, sir, they surely would.
Sunday, January 16th, noon, Quantico, Virginia. Michaels looked up as Tony came into his office.
"More good news?"
"Maybe we can't wait on White's chartered jet to deliver Mr. Thomas Hughes to us after all."
"Never rains, but it pours. What?"
"It seems that less than an hour ago, FBI field agents who went to Chicago's O'Hare Airport goofed up."
"Best and worst case scenarios?"
"Best case, they find Platt hiding behind a shipment of lawn furniture 5 minutes from now and take him into custody, whereupon he spills his guts. Hughes comes home, we grab him, he gets 50 years, and dies in jail when he's 100. Michaels smiled at her.
"I like that one."
"Worst case scenario, Platt gets away. Hughes hunkers down behind his money and lives happily ever after in the guest room at the presidential palace, then dies at 100 from eating too much caviar."
"Did you lay out what's going on for the colonel?"
"Not yet."
"Call him. Find out what our chances are of going in and grabbing Hughes."
"Are we ready to take that road yet, Alex?"
"This guy terrorized the country, caused people to die, and stole a shitload of money. I want to see him behind bars."
"I'll call the colonel." Sunday, January 16th, 5 p.m., Bissau, Guinea-Bissau. Hughes stood on the terraced balcony outside his room, looking over the pink buildings of the compound at the surrounding grounds. The deal with Domingos had gone as smoothly as it could have gone. $100 million had gone into El Presidente's private Swiss account, and the mineral rights for the country of Guinea-Bissau now belonged almost entirely to Thomas Hughes. The oil, bauxite, and phosphates alone were potentially worth billions. At least that's what Hughes's geologists and petroleum engineers had told him. If ever a man had been in the driving seat and in control of the bus, it was Thomas Hughes. When Platt showed up, he'd be getting a little surprise. He was expecting to come and collect $20 million, then vanish. He was half right, anyway. Sunday, January 16th, 3 p.m., in the air, over the North Atlantic Ocean. Platt had the 767 to himself, save for the flight crew. He was on his way to merry old England to catch a flight to Senegal. He didn't want to be landing at Bissau Airport. No, not hardly. That would get back to the Presidente pretty quick, and from the Presidente's lips into Hughes's ear, and that wouldn't do at all. Platt wanted his appearance to be a real surprise. It would be real tempting to break Hughes into itty-bitty pieces once he got to him, but all he really wanted was his $20 million.
Well, okay, maybe a little extra for his aggravation and all. That would be fair. Platt laughed aloud.
Oh, yeah, it would.
Sunday, January 16th, 1:35 p.m., in the air, over Virginia. Still flying home on the Air Force transport, Howard opened a shielded comm with Julio Fernandez at Net Force HQ.
What are we going to run into if we drop in unannounced on the Republic of Guinea-Bissau?
Sir, the country is defended by something called the People's Revolutionary Armed Force. They have a small army, about 9 boats worth of navy, and an air force consisting of a few prop planes and surplus helicopters.
What else?
They got zip railroads and under 3,000 kilometers of paved road. There are fewer than 4,000 telephones. They got 3 FM radio stations, 4 AM stations. They like rock and country and western, and a lot of trash talk. There are 2 TV stations, one of the latter of which doesn't sign on until dark.
Sounds like a place to do my next survival trip.
If we cruise in over them any more than 100 feet up, we'll be safe, because none of the locals can throw their spears that high.
Howard laughed.
I should be landing in about half an hour. Meet me there.
Yes, sir.
Monday, January 17th, 11 a.m., Quantico, Virginia. Michaels said,
All right, I think that's it. Questions?
Nobody spoke.
Good. You all have your assignments. Better go and get started.
The others left. Tony stayed behind.
This is not a good idea, Alex.
You heard the colonel. It should work.
You know I'm not talking about the operation. I'm talking about you going along. It's dangerous.
Crossing the street is dangerous.
He saw she was really concerned about him, and he didn't want to be flip, so he said,
What would make you feel better about this?
You not going.
Aside from that,
she looked him straight in the eyes.
If I went with you.
He started to shake his head.
I need somebody here to run things.
For 3 or 4 days, bring in Chavez from Knights. Shift Preston from Operations.
I don't know.
Oh, it's fine for you to go play in the field, but not me.
Okay, said Michaels, holding up his hands in surrender. Okay, you're right. You can go. That way we'll both be looking for new jobs if this goes sour.
I can live with that.
Good. Now go take care of those other details we need handled, okay?
Monday, January 17th. 6 p.m., Bissau, Guinea-Bissau. Hughes sipped at his drink, a good brandy, in a monogrammed crystal snifter, and frowned at the president's chauffeur-stroke-bodyguard.
You sure?
Sorry, sir, but he wasn't on the plane. I would have recognized him.
Yes, well, thank you anyway. This is a concern for you,
Domingo said. Not really. Platt will show up sooner or later. I have his money, and the arrangement was for him to collect it in person.
Giles will take care of him whenever he arrives. Not to worry.
Hughes swirled the brandy, lifted the snifter to his lips, and sipped it.
I'm not worried at all, Mr. President.
Monday, January 17th. 7 p.m., Tanaf, Senegal. Platt had driven his rented Land Rover to Saint-Dieu, then south to Tanaf. From there, if he stayed on the road, he was only about 5 miles away from Senegal's southern border with Guinea-Bissau. He'd picked up 2 World War II surplus hand grenades, German potato mashers, the dealer told him, old but guaranteed to work. If he ran into some local soldiers who wanted to give him grief, he'd see if he could mash them like potatoes. Nobody in this dark land was going to stop him getting where he wanted to go, not without being real sorry if they tried. The fence that protected the border was 3 whole strands of rusted barbed wire tacked to wooden posts that were mostly rotted away. He hacked most of the way through one of the posts with the K-bar, then knocked it the rest of the way down with the Rover's front bumper and rolled across the border.
Welcome to Guinea-Bissau, Hoss.
He figured he needed to get fairly close to the city, then find himself a place to hide the Rover, because he'd need it to leave. And he'd have to hold up for a day, until tomorrow night, because he definitely didn't want to be moving around during the day. Tuesday night, good and dark, he'd mosey on in and do his business. No two ways about it. He was going to take a little more than 20 million when he talked to Hughes. He sure had it coming. Monday, January 17th. 9 p.m., in the air, over the Atlantic Ocean.
Heads up, here comes the colonel,
Joanna whispered.
Sir,
Fernandez said, as John Howard stopped next to their seats.
Sergeant? Lieutenant?
Howard looked at them for a couple of seconds, then smiled. After the colonel left, Joanna looked at Fernandez.
What was that all about?
Fernandez grinned widely.
I expect the colonel knows that you and I have been intimate.
How would he know that? You bragging?
No, ma'am. As proud as I am of it, I didn't say a word.
Brought your wavy knife, I see, Alex said.
Tony looked up and nodded. She had the kris in its wooden scabbard on her lap.
Guru is convinced the kris is magic. I figured it wouldn't hurt.
He nodded, then said,
I'm just going to have a few words with the colonel. Looks like everything is on schedule. We'll be at the airport in a few more hours.
So far, he hadn't said anything to her about the I love you part. She wouldn't push it. She would see what happened. The magic in the kris had gotten her this far. Maybe it would help take her the rest of the way. Tuesday, January 18th, 6 p.m., Bissau, Guinea-Bissau. Hughes enjoyed his cigar and brandy in solitude. Well, save for the brief appearance of a messenger who informed him that the 5 o'clock plane had come and that once again Platt was not on it. This was worrisome. What if somehow Platt had run foul of the law? What if he'd been captured? He didn't think Platt would say anything about their venture. It would hardly be in his best interest to do so. Still, what if somehow he was made to speak? Going back to the U.S. would be out of the question. As soon as he stepped off the plane, the feds would swoop down on him like a hawk on a chicken. What to do? The least risky proposition was simply to sit tight. He wasn't due to return to the U.S. from Ethiopia until Thursday, so he had a couple of days. If Platt hadn't shown up by then, Hughes would put in a call to the senator and offer some reason why he had to stay in Africa a few more days. Tuesday, January 18th, 9 p.m., Banjul, The Gambia. Michaels felt lulled by the rain and the heat. This was supposed to be the dry season. The monsoons were supposed to be over. Howard had a map projected on a more or less white concrete block wall.
This is the city of Bissau.
He waved a laser pointer in a circle of red around the presidential palace.
This is the compound.
There were 34 people in the room. Howard had brought 4 5-troop squads, not counting Fernandez and Winthrop. He put the map up again.
We'll land here, about 2 miles from the target, where we will switch to local transport. We're set to collect the package at 0130 hours. Any questions so far?
Nobody had any.
After Beta Team collects the package, we will rendezvous with Alpha at the assembly point, then proceed to the landing site. Whatever our status on the ground, the Hueys will lift at 0230 hours and proceed on the prearranged flight path back to Banjul. If you miss the bus, you'll have a long walk home. We leave in 1 hour. Dismissed.
The pilots and squads filed out into the rain, which was finally beginning to slacken. Michaels, Tony, Winthrop, and Fernandez stayed behind with the colonel.
We're set, then. Winthrop will be with me on Beta Team. Sergeant Fernandez leads Alpha. Our projections run between 88% and 93% success.
Michaels nodded. I'll see you at the transports in 55 minutes. Tuesday, January 18th, 11 p.m., Bissau, Guinea-Bissau. Platt hated this damned country. He looked at his watch for the 50th time since it got dark. He was about a mile from the Pink Palace. He'd planned to wait until around midnight before he headed there, but Platt had had enough of this hanging around. He was going now. He changed into a black T-shirt and black pants, with black tennis shoes and black socks. What skin showed was stained pretty dark, and it wouldn't show up too well at night. He was going to move careful, so it might take him a couple 3 hours to get where he was going. If Hughes had company in bed, they were going to get a surprise about 1:30 or 2 a.m. Platt was looking forward to it. 12:40 a.m. Howard piled into the ancient pickup truck and dropped the piece of canvas that covered the back opening.
Go!
One of the Beta team drove. Alpha team was already on the road, in a similarly dilapidated vehicle. Howard had been assured that no matter how bad they looked, the trucks were mechanically sound and would take them to and from wherever they wanted to go. He sure hoped so.
You all right, Lieutenant?
Sir, I'm fine.
Then she said, Actually, I'm a little nervous, sir. He smiled at her.
Only a little? I personally am scared spitless.
pucker factor of about 12.
Really? You?
If you don't feel fear, you can't be brave. Brave is when your bowels are like ice, and you're terrified, but you go out and do the job anyway. I don't want troopers who are fearless. They're the first ones who get taken out when the situation gets hot. Fearless and stupid go together.
Thank you, sir.
1 a.m. Hughes got up and went to the bathroom. He shouldn't drink anything after 10 at night. He was a little peeved, too. Monique hadn't shown up tonight. He suspected she either had a local lover or went off to do drugs. Some of the locals grew prime ganja. It wasn't hard to come by. He waded back through the thick carpet to bed. The hum of the air conditioner would put him back to sleep soon enough. 1:15 a.m. Getting into the compound had been harder than Platt had figured. Shit, every time he turned around, things were tougher than he'd expected. He'd been here before, on the inside, but he'd never figured he'd be going in over the wall next time he came to visit. But there was a way in, if he didn't mind getting covered with old banana peels and coffee grounds, a trash chute coming out of the kitchen that led into a big metal container next to the kitchen exit. Platt headed for the chute. 1:25 a.m. Howard and Beta Team went in over the east wall, moved through the orange grove, got to the prearranged position, spread out, and went prone. Howard looked at his watch. He held up his hand, three fingers spread.
In 3 minutes, people.
1:30 a.m. Julio Fernandez counted the seconds off, aloud. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Then he pressed the detonator stud on the infrared control. 200 yards away, a low-roofed warehouse, stored full of cashews and palm kernels for export, went up in a blinding white flash.
Now that's how to roast cashews, Fernandez said.
Okay, we're out of here. Roll!
1:30 a.m. The warehouse flashed brightly, followed in a couple of seconds by the sound of the explosion. Lights went on in the main building.
Move in,
Howard commanded. There was nobody in the hall to stop them. The main staircase was just ahead.
Third floor. Go, go!
1:31 a.m. Platt was in the kitchen, scraping what smelled and looked like fermented mayonnaise off his arm, when he heard an explosion in the distance that rattled the hanging pots and pans. He scooted across the room and opened the door to the electric dumbwaiter. He hit the button for the third floor, then squeezed himself into the little box and let the door shut. He heard somebody make it into the kitchen and start yelling in oogaboog as the dumbwaiter lifted, but by then they didn't know where he was. 1:33 a.m. Howard raised his foot and kicked the door open. Winthrop dived in and rolled, just as she had done in VR so many times. Thomas Hughes, dressed in white silk pajamas, sat up in bed, where he had obviously been sleeping until that moment.
Who the hell are you? What do you want?
The colonel stepped in behind Winthrop.
Mr. Hughes, he said.
He smiled.
Commander Alexander Michaels at NetForce would like to have a word with you.
I don't think so,
somebody said. Winthrop snapped her gaze to the glass door leading out to the balcony.
Platt!
You look better in person than you do in VR, honey. How about you put those guns down?
How about I just shoot you instead?
Bad idea. Ask your jig friend there why.
She glanced at the colonel.
He's holding some kind of grenade, Howard said. I think if I shoot you, both you and that grenade will fall off that balcony behind you.
Ah, Platt said. But then I would die, and you don't want that. Now do you?
Damn, Winthrop thought. She knew that Platt was right, and so did Colonel Howard. She'd heard Commander Michaels telling him all about the dead man switches. Even now, Jay Gridley was working furiously to defuse the things.
God damn it, Gridley, she thought. Hurry up.
What do you want?
Howard said.
Well, we need to come to some kind of arrangement.
Platt smiled. 2:05 a.m., Bissau, Guinea-Bissau. At the helicopters, the pilots were relaxed, laughing and joking. Michaels and Tony weren't so animated. The truck rounded a curve a couple of hundred yards out, and as soon as it did, it blinked its lights off, and then on again.
It's them, Tony said.
Michaels felt himself relax a little. The truck pulled to a stop, and Sergeant Fernandez stepped out. He frowned.
Beta team is not back. I think we have to give the colonel a call.
We're not supposed to break radio silence, except in an emergency.
Sir, we're supposed to lift in 25 minutes. It's an emergency.
Michaels nodded. Yeah.
2:06 a.m. Howard had his pistol trained on Platt, as did Winthrop. Platt, meanwhile, waved the grenade back and forth like it was a spinning reel and he was fly fishing for bass in a pond.
"Put that thing away," Hughes said. "Are you crazy?"
"No, sir. What I am is pissed off. You owe me $30 million, and I want it."
$30 million?
"Yeah, I figure I'm due a little extra."
From the hall, Martin called, "Colonel, is everything okay in there?"
"Affirmative, but listen up. Collect the rest of Beta Team and take the truck back to the rendezvous point, ASAP.
"Sir, what about you and the package?"
"We're involved in some delicate negotiations in here. Get back to the rendezvous, you copy?"
Yes, sir.
"Good move," Platt said. "Listen up, Colonel Sambo. Here's the deal. I need Hughes. You want him for your own reasons. Let's go somewhere I can get what I want, then you can have him."
"I don't much like your deal."
"Only one I'm offering."
Howard shook his head. This guy was dangerous, at the very least. Maybe crazy enough to let that grenade go and kill or maim them all.
"Let's move."
"Age before beauty," Platt said.
As Howard turned to leave the room, he reached down with his left hand and triple-tapped the panic button on his comm. 2:10 a.m.
"Aw, shit," Fernandez said. "My comm just started a bleeper pulse. The colonel has pushed his panic button. That means he's down or captured. He can't talk."
"We're supposed to lift in 20 minutes, one of the pilots said.
Michaels said, "We don't leave until we bring our people out."
"Sir, the colonel's orders..."
"Negative. Let's move, Sergeant. Time is running out."
2:15 a.m. Howard, Platt, Hughes, and Winthrop moved out.
"Why do they call it a potato masher?"
Winthrop said, trying to distract the man.
"Because of the shape," Platt said. "You see, narrow here, on the handle, but fat down here. You take your cooked potatoes and pound away at them like this."
He moved the grenade up and down, as if using it to smash things under the heavy end.
"See?"
2:20 a.m.
"Randall, what are they doing?"
Fernandez asked.
"Still moving, Sarge. Got to be on foot, slow as they're going."
"Same direction as before?"
"Yep."
"Get us in front of them, Butler. Half a mile or so, then shut it down." "You have a plan?"
Tony asked.
"Hold on a second. Somebody's calling."
"Go ahead." "Sergeant Fernandez, this is Martin. Beta Team is at the rendezvous, except for Colonel Howard and Lieutenant Winthrop."
"You know what happened to them?"
"Negative. All he said was he was doing some kind of negotiation."
"We're going to collect the colonel and the lieutenant now. See if you can shoo away anybody who comes nosing around until we get back."
"Affirmative, Sarge."
2:25 a.m.
"Where are we going?"
Howard asked.
"Not too much further," Platt said. "A half mile or so. I have my ride stashed up ahead."
Platt saw Winthrop and Howard exchange quick looks.
"I got nothing to gain by killing anybody here, and you got your guns and all right. You get your big-time thief and most of the money back. I get paid what I'm owed, and I'm gone. Now, don't that sound like a good deal all the way around?"
Howard didn't say anything, but what he was thinking was,
"Damn it, Gridley, we're about out of time here. Move your ass."
2:30 a.m. "This doesn't make any sense," Michaels whispered to Tony. "That's Hughes in the white pajamas, and I'm pretty sure the big guy behind him is Platt."
"Hostage scenario," Tony said. "You have an SOP for this, don't you?"
"Standard negotiations for hostage situations are based on psychology and hours or days to work. We don't have the time."
At that moment, Michael's Virgil vibrated. It was Gridley.
"Got him, boss. Every last one of them."
"Good work, Jay."
Disconnecting, he looked around him.
"Jay did it. Get ready to get our people out of there. Now."
He stood and stepped out of the bushes.
"Hold it right there, asshole."
Howard made his move. He leapt, grabbed the hand holding the grenade, squeezed it tight in both his.
"Shoot, Winthrop! Shoot!"
Startled, Joanna pointed her pistol and fired, but Platt spun, and the bullet spanged off the colonel's back armor. Things went in slow motion, as Platt pulled a knife from his belt, even as he danced around in a circle, with Howard holding onto his other hand.
"Adios, black boy."
Michael's gun was still in its holster. He was the only one close enough to shoot and hit Platt. He pulled it, but Platt spun Howard around, and once again the bullet hit the colonel's armor. Damn! Michaels turned, saw Tony. She had already tossed something at Howard. The Chris! Howard let go of the grenade hand, snatched the wavy-bladed knife from the air, turned, twisted into Platt, stabbed, as Platt stabbed. Platt snarled as his knife hit Howard's armor and skidded off. The Chris's point slipped between Platt's ribs, the blade sinking in until the hilt almost touched the center of the big man's chest. Michaels dropped the gun, dived, rolled, came up with the bomb, and threw it into the trees on his left. Down! Boom! Something burned along Michael's arm. He frowned. A long time passed. A couple of thousand years, Michaels figured. Tony grabbed him, and he realized he was still alive. His ears rang. They looked down at Platt, who was still breathing. Platt said,
"Damn, I can't believe it. A nigger."
Howard didn't say anything. Platt stared at Howard.
"I hate this fucking country. Killed by a goddamn nigger."
Platt's last breath escaped, and he collapsed. Michaels bent, and with some difficulty, pulled the Chris from Platt. He wiped it off on the man's shirt, then gave it back to Tony.
"Let's go, people. We got a helicopter to catch."
Saturday, January 22nd, 8 a.m., Washington, D.C. In his own bed, Michaels woke up slowly and rolled from his right side onto his back. The ride back from Guinea-Bissau had been relatively uneventful. The locals had never gotten around to finding the helicopters, at least not until after they were in the air, and the flight from Banjul couldn't have been smoother. All in all, the director wasn't too upset, and everybody in the regular FBI and Net Force was happy to hear the great silence from the offices of Senator Robert White after his chief of staff was indicted. So, things had turned out pretty well.
"Alex?"
He looked up. Tony, naked and gloriously beautiful, stood at the foot of the bed, beaming down at him.
"You want some coffee? I can go and make you some."
He smiled at her.
"Maybe later. I've got something else in mind, just at this moment."
"Oh? And what might that be?"
"Come here, and I'll show you."
She did, and then he did. That turned out pretty well, too. And the coffee didn't get made until almost noon.
Another title in the NetForce series, created by Tom Clancy and Steve Pachenik, available on audio from Random House, is Tom Clancy's NetForce, read by Carrie Shale. This has been a Random House audiobooks presentation. Production copyright 1999, Random House, Inc., all rights reserved.